The Off the Ball Podcast Network. OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Well, a very good morning to you. There's only one place that we can start last night, and it's the Carabao Cup, and it's with Aston Villa's miraculous victory against Wolves, right? The Black Country Derby. That's what everybody's talking about this morning, Owen. Right?
Just catching up on it now.
Right? Isn't it?
Was watching some popcorn TV last night instead of watching the real stuff.
Yeah, I mean, who cares about Marcus Rashford's free kick?
The real heavy...
Green Kelleher's save.
The real character arc was between Wolves and Aston Villa. Bragging rights forever, I think.
I think, look, if you can't tattoo the two on your forehead. If you can't beat Wolves' B team, then, and if you can't celebrate that like it's a World Cup win, what's the point in being a football fan?
There really is no point whatsoever in being a football fan. There was a little bit of FOMO last night even with Marcus Rashford's goal kind of coming up on Twitter. There's nothing quite like seeing goals like that live.
No, because it is a proper shock.
Yeah.
The way the ball travelled, as Tommy said, first time we've seen the ball travel like that since which World Cup? 2002 World Cup?
2010, when they had the crazy ball in South Africa.
The Jabulani.
Yeah. Is that the name of it?
Yeah, Jabulani.
Right, okay. Well remembered. The only word I remember from that World Cup is Vuvuzela and Shabalala, but the Jabulani is not a word I remember. But it did move like that. It moved like a ball that Cristiano Ronaldo could get moving.
Play with a different ball. There's a Carabao Cup ball. I don't know what it is.
Yes, actually, you're right. And didn't Manchester City complain about that last season?
Did they?
Pep Guardiola wasn't too happy with the movement on the ball in the early stages of last season's Carabao Cup.
It looks like a mitre, though, doesn't it?
It is a mitre.
Yeah.
Yeah, it certainly is a mitre. And they weren't happy with it last year, so it probably just moves
a little bit more. We had a Premier League ball in here a while ago. It's obviously been nicked.
What, because if you had the ball here, you'd be able to tell us how Marcus Rashford wouldn't
exactly
be able
how
to
it worked, you know?
Move it just as well.
Yeah, I mean, it would be the most David Brent thing in the world to do. Here's how this superstar teenage athlete did what he did last night.
I can see it over there. It's underneath a bit of furniture on the other side of the studio.
I just wanted to see what type of ball
it is.
It's
an Umbro.
It is an Umbro, okay, so... Very different, and obviously Marcus Rashford knew exactly what he was doing.
He really did. I thought coming in this morning it was the goal of the night, but then I actually watched back all the Arsenal goals a moment ago. That's a great tweet from Victor Lindelof. That's Cristiano Ronaldo against Portsmouth on the left-hand side. But I thought coming in this morning that it was the best goal of the night, but actually Joe Welleck's goal was better. Just about Marcus Rashford in a comfortable second, perhaps. Ox's goal was fairly sensational as well. And you got to love a bit of Ozil's back heel for Maitland-Niles. It was just, you know, when you see those things pop up on social media where it's like, look at this outrageous thing that Lionel Messi did in training or some player did in training. That's what the Carabao Cup is.
Yeah.
It's like lads playing in training, except it actually counts in a real life competitive competition, which isn't really that competitive. Like Jurgen Klopp looked like kind of a proud dad whose son is a bit more talented than he realised last night. Unai Emery took off Mesut Ozil when he was the best player on the pitch. So
why did he do that? Was it like to punish him or something? Or I mean, surely he wants to win.
Yeah, I also think, for me, it didn't make sense whatsoever on a basic level, but also on a level of optics. It's like Unai Emery, the situation that he's been in already by kind of freezing Mesut Ozil out at times has been like shooting himself in the foot, except he's missed his foot. And now he's got the opportunity to shoot himself in the foot again, despite the fact that he's got off the hook. But he goes ahead and pulls the trigger anyway and takes Ozil off. So straight away, you're creating... The divide's already been created, but you're pushing Ozil further away when it comes to the optics of the situation. Now, behind closed doors, they may have patched things up and everything might be fine. But last night isn't exactly going to do any favours for Emery. The Jose Mourinho rumour mill has started to trundle along nicely now. He wants to come back to the Premier League. He wants to win a third Premier League title. And... would it be so un-Arsenal to the point that it would be very Arsenal to appoint Jose Mourinho at this point?
It's so Arsenal to sign Jose Mourinho after he's a busted flush and not capable of managing in the Premier League anymore and to fritter away another 2.5 seasons because they'll give him a year too long and they'll give him 500 million and he'll buy a bunch of centre-backs who aren't very good, who can't pass the ball to each other and who are just like massive, robust defenders who will play in midfield and up front.
Wasn't the problem that he couldn't...
Eight centre-backs is what he'll play.
But that was the problem at Manchester United. He couldn't sign the centre-backs. He didn't have the backing of Edward Ward.
He signed quite a few.
But in the last season, the season when he was going to sign well, when Raphael Varane and Koulibaly...
Oh, yeah.
Were on offer.
He's got no chance of getting. He may as well be signing, I'm going to sign Rio Ferdinand, or the ghost of Rio Ferdinand, or whoever. It's not going to happen. Klopp speaking last night, I enjoyed every second of the game. This is after the 5-all draw. Klopp speaking after the 4-1 win against Genk. I didn't enjoy the game too much. He looked like he enjoyed himself afterwards.
Yeah, very much so.
So the match winner Curtis Jones, he gets a bit of a hug. He's like, ah, oh, good man, Curtis. But Queevan Keller, he gets a big, long embrace.
Is that right? I missed that embrace.
Yeah, he's like, ah. Dude was like, oh, just counting the seconds there. That's like a, there's some warmth there.
For sure. And like Queevan Keller, when you concede 5 goals in a game, to end up as a hero
it's
is
pretty good, isn't
an
it?
Amazing start to a professional career, senior career.
I missed the game. I saw the shootout. But how many of the goals was he at fault for?
He was at direct fault for one of the goals for me because...
I'll be saying two.
Two, potentially. But to be fair, Lucas Torreira was offside when he put the ball in the back of the net. I presume that that's one of the goals he's referring to. And then I think it was the second Arsenal goal as well. The ball was going wide, but Kevin Gallagher got a hand to it. Close quarters. It was a reaction save. And Arsenal finished off the rebound. So
your tweets last night were how I kind of rediscovered what happened in the game. It was essentially saying there's no way Arsenal can screw this up.
Well, that's obviously what I wasn't saying. If that's what I was saying, then I was clearly being sarcastic. If anybody ever says to you, Arsenal can't screw this up, their tongue is in their cheek or they don't know what they're talking about. Simple as that.
Important to clarify that Arsenal bottling this from here, I presume this
is 5-4.
5-4.
Yeah.
Important to clarify that Arsenal bottling this from here would not be typical Arsenal. Typical Arsenal would be going on to win 7-4, Ozil and Emery embracing in public, and Arsenal fan TV star naming their kid Gabrielle, and then Arsenal losing to Colchester in the quarterfinals.
So they didn't go full Arsenal.
It was pretty close.
At least they took it to penalties and then got beaten by a guy we'd never heard of before.
7-5, the Reading game.
That was the Reading game. And yeah. Then they ended up getting knocked out by Bradford in the next round, I think.
On penalties, yeah.
On penalties.
Somebody that was. Did you know that or was that just from reading?
I remember that season very well. I was going to tweet last night if Arsenal had won that the Carabao tastes oddly like Carling tonight because, you know, the peak years of Jack Wilshere and Fran Morita and Abu Diaby, Johan Giroud, taking us through the likes of Reading and perhaps Liverpool or Manchester United in a quarter final and then inevitably losing to Chelsea at some point.
Coca-Cola Cup was, one of those things that Aston Villa were very good at.
That we see the cup.
After milk and before booze.
But milk cup, Coca-Cola Cup, so peak Aston Villa, early to mid-90s. Was that Coca-Cola Cup or was that milk cup?
It was all Coca-Cola Cup. Villa.
Fair enough. Because I would have thought that your peak League Cup comes after your actual peak. So peak Arsenal came right after the Invincibles in the Carling Cup.
That was the peak. maybe this is as good as it gets.
Maybe it is. Maybe it is. But I always thought of the Carling Cup as like the residue for a team that could no longer win the Premiership at the time.
Residue is not a great word there, Owen, is it? It's Halloween today, Owen. Happy birthday. 2 years we've been doing the show together.
Yes, congratulations.
I didn't realise until yesterday that you actually despise Halloween, that you think it's the worst time of year, the worst day of the year.
I actually can't think of a worse day, really. It's maybe the day after New Year's Day is up there just for like New Year's fear and all that sort of stuff. But generally, by definition of what the day entails, Halloween is the worst day.
Why?
Just what is the point of Halloween? What is the point of Halloween?
Apple bobbing, getting dressed up.
Apple bobbing. What is the point of that? Like
sweets.
Pick up an apple and eat it. There's no point in putting it into a bucket of water to actually get one of your 5 a day. The thing that really gets me is like fireworks. Fireworks are absolutely idiotic. If they're professionally organised and they look nice and are kind of a form of art, fair enough. Brilliant, beautiful. Congratulations to everybody involved. But the actual form of setting them off because you enjoy hearing a bang, then, you know, that for me just isn't, like, what is the point of that? Where do you have to be to say, I'm going to enjoy the sound of a massive bang?
I mean...
Or the sight of a massive bang?
I mean, like, you obviously did. Was there an incident when you were a child? Was there, like, someone let fireworks loose in coppers, apparently? Did someone let fireworks loose in your bedroom, your class? Did they used to... As you were walking to school, you'd have to run the gauntlet of the local Kerry youths firing fireworks at you?
No, we don't really have footpaths, so walking to school would never really been an option.
On the road, with a bit of grass at the middle of it.
Yeah, it's a good image there you have of our county. No, it's just, it's pure logic.
Okay.
Like, I appreciate fireworks. You give me BBC midnight, 31st of December, great display. London looks amazing as a result of the fireworks. Northside Dublin, 31st of October. You don't know where they're going off, but they're going off. You're like, get me in and out of this absolute racket. It's the worst time of year, without question. And
do you not dress up?
No.
Never go to a costume party?
I haven't done it in years. The last thing I dressed up as was Dexter from Dexter's Laboratory.
They're laughing. I don't know what that is.
The Cartoon Network cartoon?
No.
It's one of the few ginger-haired cartoon characters, so... I didn't have to do that part of the costume.
Right.
So it was kind of like,
it's just a doctor's glasses, black glasses and doctor's coat.
Yeah, and then gloves as well. So yeah, he was a great old character, Dexter. Missed him.
Right, and everybody knew who he was, yeah.
Yeah, they actually did. I was very surprised by that. I thought there'd be kind of like an explainer, but no.
Oh, there he is. Okay, I get it now. Sorry, yes. Okay, didn't know the name.
There you go. So, no. We've just been told into our ear, where do we go from here? Which, I'm not sure, was that like dubbing Dexter's mouth there or not, but no. Do you enjoy Halloween, do you? I think it's...
Yeah, Halloween's class. I'm going trick-or-treating with the kids tonight for the first time properly.
Don't come to my house.
Well, you better have stuff if I do.
I've actually gone to sleep at like 6 p.m. on Halloween just to kind of shut myself away from the world on Halloween night. It was midweek, to be fair, but I just don't understand it. Don't understand the craze.
I got a costume in Japan.
Oh?
Yeah. A giant edamame, you know, the peas, it's called Peas to Meet You. And it's a long, giant green bean, which unfortunately looks a bit phallic. So it's like...
So what exactly are you going for as Peas to Meet You? That is your costume. Are you a pun guy when it comes to your costume at Halloween?
Well, that's what the...
Yeah, but like, I get it. But is that... Oh, it actually says it. So there's actually no explaining involved.
Well, no, it says it on the thing that you buy. It doesn't say... There's no sign saying Peas to Meet You.
That would be fair.
It might be, because otherwise it's going to look like a little bit unsafe. Anyway, let's move on. We have a brilliant interview with Owen Larkin coming up at 8 o'clock this morning. These Kilkenny books have actually given a massive insight into what it was like to be part of the greatest hurling team of all time and one of the greatest GAA teams of all time. I mean, there's a case that they're probably better than the Dublin footballers, even though they didn't do the five, because they've had stiff competition across the time. Isn't there?
I'm not sure about that.
A better team than the Dublin footballers?
I'm not sure. Maybe they, like, I think maybe...
Stiffer competition.
At the start... Well, okay, so...
Tipperary team were sensational.
Tipperary and Cork, they're the two kind of big challenges. Are they better than the Mayo Kerry team of this Kerry team's...
More Ireland.
Yeah, probably, actually.
Certainly the Mayo.
Like, we'll probably know how good the Dublin team is after
when
the five
finish.
Yeah, when they finish.
Fair
like, because we knew how good the Tip team was come 2010, really, rather than in 2009... Well, granted then, 2010 was the end of the five in a row, so we should have an idea now of this.
But then Kilkenny came back and continued.
And doing that about three in a row, like that's 14, 15.
Against that Tip team.
Yeah, that's actually outrageous. Two in a row. So like the 2013 was like kind of the only kind of real dip year for Kilkenny, and then even part of that year, Cody was away, so it kind of tells you all you need to know about the strength of the manager.
All right, here's a little taster of the interview with Owen Larkin coming up. Have a look.
Was there lads that Cody tended to give a bit more of a break to? Like, was there a teacher's pet when it came to Brian Cody?
I don't think there was actually a teacher's pet. He did love Tommy Welsh. He loved everything that was about him. You know, he loved the way he went about the game. He loved his attitude towards it. He loved, you know, that it meant so much to him. And, you know, like, I obviously got on well with him because I'm from the same club. Jackie got on well with him. The lads will tell you I was his pet. That's not true. But, no,
why did you have that impression?
I don't know, it's just a bit of crack we had, I suppose, but like I was his pet, Tommy Welsh was definitely his pet, so no, look, he had a bit of crack with a few lads, and you know, a few lads kind of stayed clear and just done what they had to do and that kind of stuff, but I don't think there was any teacher's pet or kind of anything like that.
There's a lot of antipathy for that Kilkenny team to the Cork team that they beat in... So Cork did two in a row, they stopped three in a row, and then Kilkenny
dominated.
Took off. Yeah.
Yeah, and in print, it's replicated kind of in the interview. We get into it a good bit later on, and he suggests that Donal Logue's career, if he was a Kilkenny man, wouldn't have lasted too long under Brian Cody. The notion of, say, a strike would have been crushed fairly quickly in Kilkenny, and that is also going along the lines that whatever Cork felt they had at the time, in Kilkenny's opinion, Kilkenny had something similar as well. They weren't a million miles away, that perhaps what Cork felt they were lacking, they actually weren't from a Kilkenny context. So it's interesting to hear that. There is no love lost at times. Like, we've heard stories before famously of like bitterness on all-star trips and things like that. It's not exactly one of those things that once the final whistle blows on the first Sunday of September, as it used to be...
They forget about it.
Yeah, it felt like it spilled over.
Nursed grudges.
Yeah, and like when it spills over from season to season, which it seemed to do, that it's going to spill into their after hurling lives as well, because it becomes such an ingrained part of their hurling identity. So Cork, I would say, is public enemy number one to Owen Larkin. Tipperary, probably public enemy number two. We only get into that a small bit in the interview.
Why did they like beating Tip?
They've thought that the notion that Tip brought along for 2010, so they used to have a trigger when Tip scored goals where the forwards would come out and start tapping their head, as in, like, we don't let this slip.
The tip forwards.
So, I don't know, it was a psychological trigger or something like that. And Larkin just thought to himself that this is bullshit. Like, this just, like, what are you doing? Like, you're making a fool of yourselves here. And I think that actually...
None of this fancy sports psychology for us, lads.
Exactly. And he says that was a huge motivating factor in 2011 when they come back to beat Tip once again. Like, we start off talking about sports psychology. There's a great... We spoke about Jerry McEntee on the show yesterday. There's a great kind of two-page bit in the book where they talk about going to Padraig Harrington's... they go to Sackstown to meet Padraig Harrington, and he's talking about, like, the left side of the brain and the right side of the brain and how you can feed into all of this. And the lads are like, what is he on about? And in the next page, Jerry McEntee is giving them analogies about drowning some lads, and they're like, yeah, this is what we're into. So, like, Cody is like the best, I think, one of the best sports psychologists of all, because he puts it into terms that don't seem like it's science.
Yeah, we don't do tactics. You're just going to stand over there, and yes, whenever they have the ball over there, you need to have,
like, one of the things that, like, in terms of not doing tactics, like, I'm not sure it's been said before, but it was a very simple thing. Like, Jim Gavin and modern coaches give this line all the time, that they empower the players to take the game into their own hands or to figure things out themselves. And I do think there's an element of Brian Cody in terms of his agreement to that as well, because Larkin said that if a game wasn't going for you, if you were kind of struggling to find your way into a big game, Cody would just give you the license to go wherever you wanted. Just go and make a tackle, win a ball back, and then suddenly that endorphin rush or whatever might actually work your way out, go back in corner forward, then you might puck a ball over the bar. It's just, maybe that is kind of the Cody method of a trigger, of actually changing your mindset a little bit.
Yeah, well, at the peak of their powers, you didn't know where Henry Shefflin was going to play. He could play inside, he could play centre forward, he could go out half forward, and it never looked like they were pre-planned. Like, 15 minutes gone here now, Henry's got to do a shift at left half forward. It was like, on him.
Yeah.
You could see him walking out and going and ordering people in. Like, you don't do that if you've got a tyrant as your manager who's got you into a position
That's
where
true.
You're terrified of making mistakes. You only do that because you've got the confidence given to you by the coaching staff. 7:47 this morning, some of your comments. Lads, still watching Anthony Bourdain's travels throughout Japan since you're home. I miss the Al Live links every morning. From Kerry Star Morning. Are you missing Japan? Have you got pangs, or are you like, oh, that was part of my life, is over?
You get pangs every now and then. A bit of nice Japanese steak every now and then wouldn't go amiss. But the lights of Tokyo as well were kind of hard to leave behind. But to be fair, it's all good. I'm happy to be here.
What about bonfires? Jonesy wants to know. Flagons of the bonfire, Owen. Come on.
Bonfires are more acceptable than, like, bangers, for sure. Because, like, there's...
But what about...
There's a communal sort of sense to a bonfire. It's like, wow, look at this amazing, blazing thing. And I get that. I get why people would see that as something to be appreciated. But I just don't understand the firework. Like, why? Like, I just, what is the rush behind a big noise?
The Jack Kerouac quote: "The only people for me are the mad ones—the ones who are mad to live, mad to talk, mad to be saved, desirous of everything at the same time. The ones who never yawn or say a commonplace thing, but burn, burn, burn like fabulous yellow Roman candles exploding like spiders across the stars. And in the middle, you see the blue centre light pop, and everybody goes, ah." Oh. You never had that.
No, doesn't ring a bell whatsoever. That's the worst quote I've ever heard, actually.
You've never heard that before?
That's the worst one I've ever heard. I've never heard that before.
Wow. Okay. On the Road, Jack Kerouac, pretty famous book?
No.
No, and you don't, Roman Candle, never been like, look at this amazing thing?
Maybe this Halloween, while I've locked myself away from the trick-or-treaters, I'll get up to speed in my literature.
Cheer up, Owen, the Scrooge of Halloween, says Stephen Fraser. Darrow Tool says, Gerald make a terrifying D from Dexter's Laboratory. Who's D?
We got a picture up, I'm sure.
Damien Moigne Beastie. How are you, Damien? Haha, well said, Owen, on Halloween.
Thank you.
Another
Damien.
Halloween hater.
It's easy to hate Halloween, and I'm not saying that I'm being unique here in any way.
To hate Halloween.
It's not a hot take.
What are you scared of?
Not scared of anything.
I mean, just the bangs, the people dressed up. Terror.
If you had the option to be terrorized or not, which option do you take?
You take the terrorized. Come on, you feel alive.
No, you don't.
Oh, come on.
You feel terrified.
So you've never watched a horror movie in your life?
I don't do horror, actually. That's
You've never watched a horror movie?
I have, but I've...
You've had nightmares afterwards.
These days, yeah. I've just opted out of everything Halloween.
Right.
Cleanse.
Johnny Kennedy's been in touch to say the Sheehan house was totally the house that everyone egged. Is that what it was?
No, it wasn't, actually. That could be could have been a legitimate reason, but...
Is that just a repressed memory that we're going to somehow chisel our way through the grime of 25 years and by the end of the show you're like, that's what it is. I can go and enjoy myself now.
That would be fantastic, actually. I don't want to hate Halloween. This is just how I feel.
Henry has won 10 All-Irelands. How many Dubs have 10 All-Irelands?
That's a good point.
Is the question. And Alan Cullen says they didn't do five, end of. I mean, is it the end of, though? Is every five the same as... It's every four or every three.
But you see, in a year's time, he could be texting and saying they didn't do six in a row.
Yeah.
So, we don't know yet. I suspect that the Dublin thing will go down as a slightly, slightly better team.
Here's what's coming up on OTBAM this morning. Owen Larkin at 8:05, that interview ahead of the launch of his book, which is out now in all good bookshops. Alan Quinn is going to join us around about 8:40 from Japan. One of his final dispatches before he makes it home here next week. Talking about the Rugby World Cup final. The F2 Freestylers. Owen, what's this?
F2 Freestylers, they've got like a billion followers on Instagram. They were in studio last week with me. I'm sure people know them from their YouTube. They make more money on YouTube than Liverpool Football Club make on YouTube. They are stars of the digital world.
What do they do?
They do tricks and they freestyle.
With footballs,
yeah. Sorry, that's a fairly important nugget of information left out there. Former academy products from Arsenal and Spurs, they went down a different direction and have made an absolute killing out of their careers. They also represent Rhian Brewster, who was playing last night for Liverpool. They've got their own talent agency going on, so we had a fairly interesting chat about academies and talents and their unbelievable success over the last decade or so.
And did they sign you up?
They didn't, actually.
Phil's going to join us around about 9:15. They've got competition from your Japanese casting agent.
Yeah, exactly. Well, their people might get onto my people, and it may be all going on behind closed doors.
All right, let's bring you through the newspapers this morning. I'm going to start with the Irish Examiner. Unreal feeling, and that's Caoimhín Kelleher having made the decisive save in the penalty shootout. Kelleher delights as penalty heroics see Liverpool past Arsenal. Anthony Daly's gone through the hurling all-stars, which we haven't got to just yet, but we'll get to in a couple of minutes' time. England dressing room will hang on Farrell's final address, so they're kind of like, we're too far out from the World Cup final for there to be that much in terms of what we can actually do by way of match preview. So we're hearing from inside the England camp. Apparently, they listen to the captain's speeches. There's actually some good stuff about the backroom teams in the Examiner today. And then end of the road, Richard Keogh has Derby contract terminated for gross misconduct. Derby are such a bunch of hypocrites. The two players who were drink driving are back playing for the team. And they offered, according to reports, they offered Richard Keogh a deal to see out the rest of his contract on a pay cut. When he said no, they sacked him. So it's just about saving money. This has nothing to do with gross misconduct or the reputation of the club. Derby are hypocrites, and whatever about the rights and wrongs of the case, they're going to have to pay Richard Keogh a lot of money for this because they had a contract with him, and they clearly don't think it's that big a deal that the two lads who were driving because they're back playing. So, like, you can't have your cake and eat it. You either sack all three players, and I think a lot of people would have been very behind that, but you can't sack some of them and not somebody else. Oh, he was the captain, he's supposed to know. It's like, no, I'm sorry, they're not 16, they're grown men, they know exactly what they're doing, and by playing them you've decided that this is not gross misconduct. Hypocrites.
Yeah, it's not a decision made on the back of what they actually say it is. This is not because of Richard Keogh's conduct. This is it's a money-saving decision. It's a business decision. That's what it is from Derby County, it seems. That is the headline on the back page of the Irish Daily Mail. Keogh sacked. Irish defender refused club's huge pay cut. You've also got a picture there of Caoimhín Kelleher. Rebel yell. And tip on top again, this time in the All-Stars. Tipperary rounding off the hurling decade as they started by bagging Lee McCarthy and the lion's share of the PwC All-Star Awards. So dominating the selection, 7 awards they've got. Goalkeeper Brian Hogan, one of the more controversial decisions. Like Owen Murphy was probably, I use controversial probably a bit strongly there.
Debated.
But debated. That was probably the most debated position. Could Owen Murphy have perhaps snapped it off Brian Hogan? But when you're an All-Ireland winning goalkeeper, it's hard to take it away from you.
The Telegraph this morning, not for them, a picture of Caoimhín Kelleher. Oh no, it's the goal scorer. So youngster Jones scores winner in penalty shootout after 10 goal Anfield thriller. Five ball draw, going straight to penalties. Going straight to penalties is a good idea.
Yes.
I would.
No VAR, no extra time. Two of the worst things in football taken out immediately by the Carabao Cup.
We're like, oh, is it going straight to penalties? Yes, it is. Great. Happy days.
The Sun this morning goes with the Richard Keogh story. Keogh sacked. Ireland star is booted after drink scandal. Vinny then says it's next man up. Vinny
Are Perth. You pronouncing that the English way? Is that like because that's
what?
What's his name?
Who? Vinny Perth?
The sacked footballer.
Richard Keogh.
All right. It sounded like you were in Keogh.
Keogh? No, Keogh.
Keogh.
Yeah, Keogh. Then have I gone for like a hybrid of the English and the Irish? I can't control how I speak, Ger.
It sounded, you can't control how you speak, ultimately.
Google Fest is the
Come
headline.
On, it's one of the great moments in Irish sports content where the camera just cuts to you. It's like the best impression I've ever seen.
It is fantastic.
Ultimately.
You do it even better. You do a good Richard impression, to be fair. Google Fest is the headline there with Curtis Jones celebrating Caoimhín Kelleher inset. I would always be very angry if I heard somebody say Keogh instead of Keogh.
And then you were doing a little bit yourself.
I didn't realise that. You need to. Thanks for tipping me off there. That's a fairly sad moment for me that I'm actually saying Keogh.
The Irish Daily Mirror, their back page is Spot Stuff, and it's a picture of the team celebration. Liverpool rookies Caoimhín Kelleher and Curtis Jones were the shootout heroes after 10 goal thriller at Anfield last night. A magnificent 7 for champs. Is the Tipperary PwC GAA GPA All-Stars and then obviously Marcus Rashford at the double as well. That Chelsea team, like Chelsea are playing well at the minute. That's a good win for Man United.
Yeah, two big wins against Chelsea now this season, and Lampard is developing a bit of a bogey team in Solskjaer's Manchester United. What a way to win a game though for Marcus Rashford. Absolute corker, and every game counts really at the moment for Manchester United. They seem to be kind of flirting with the idea that form might be coming back to Old Trafford. So he was in the hot seat there for a while, I think, Solskjaer. He might have just removed himself from it now. The London Times this morning goes with a picture of Mauro Toje on the back page inside how Owen Farrell found his voice as England's leader. And FA demands Spygate answers. This is Martin Ziegler and Matt Dickinson writing how Liverpool have been asked to respond to revelations that they paid Manchester City £1 million. After a rival scouting system was allegedly hacked into. This relates to money paid in a settlement in 2013 after City complained about their system being accessed unlawfully by Liverpool club employees.
The back page of The Guardian. Is it definitely the back page?
It is, there was like an ad on the back.
Okay, so here it is. World in Harmony. George and England turned to cricketers for final inspiration. A lot of people pointing out that England World Cup winners and cricket can be World Cup winners and this, and they're European Cup winners in football and could be World Club champions by the end of the year. It's all coming up Brexit, isn't it? 2019 vision, the England coach who's already won two World Cups on the back of that. And then there's pictures of a glass bridge in China on the front of it. They kind of freak me out a bit, I'm not going to lie.
Glass bridges?
Yeah. Have you seen the video doing the rounds of the infinity pool that's out over the edge of a building where you walk out?
I haven't seen this video, but I get what you're saying.
You're looking straight down and it's like, I don't know, 80 stories down.
And like you were shaming me there a moment ago for being scared of horror movies. You can't even walk out on a bridge.
No, it's true. On a glass bridge where you're looking at your imminent death below you. Staring in the face.
He's a man up, I think, is the actual phrase. And,
I don't think it's politically incorrect these days.
Get some Halloween life.
It's person up these days, though.
Back page of the Herald is Derby sack for Keogh. Ireland defender set for legal battle as contract is terminated. There's a picture there from Ceballos' penalty getting saved by Caoimhín Kelleher. And Lopez targets final medal. Rovers ace Roberto gunning for Dundalk.
The Racing Post, the front page of the Racing Post this morning is Mullins suspended supreme, too big for one man to manage. Ken Boy's dramatic suspension from racing, along with those in the same ownership as the Cheltenham Gold Cup favourite, may be explained by management becoming overwhelmed by the rapid growth of the supreme horse racing club, trainer Willie Mullins said yesterday. Ireland's champion trainer admitted at a media event that he was aware of grumblings within the camp, before HRI froze Supreme's account on October the 21st. That intervention came after requests for paperwork relating to the ownership of horses were not sufficiently met. Owners in the syndicate have claimed that horses, including Kenboy, who can't race until the dispute is resolved, were oversold. Supreme is listed as being run by Steve Massey and Jim Balfrey, but Mullins, who trains 14 horses for the owners and remains hopeful the authorities can come to a swift resolution, said much of the onus for running the syndicates lay solely with Massey. Supreme Racing got very big, is what Mullins said. So it's a really interesting developing story in the Racing Post today. And the back page, the best of both worlds, why outsiders England can shine again. England's cricketers are going to beat New Zealand, apparently.
Sports Thursday in the Irish Times leads with Farrell's steady hand on England's tiller. Booker George says squad taking their cue from inspirational captain. That's the angle, really, across all the World Cup stories today. And then all change for Wales and All Blacks and game of farewells, says Sherry Thornley as well. That's a 9 o'clock kickoff tomorrow morning between Wales and New Zealand.
And the star this morning, the back page of the star, is Kelloween. Queen means the shootout hero after 10-goal thriller. There you go, that's not bad.
Good headline. Tab of the morning to you.
Rash is king for United and Keo to fight Derby sacking. Of course he is, because it's ridiculous.
Keo sacked over car crash roll, says the back of the Irish Independent. Derby's Ireland defender contract terminated after refusing to accept pay cut following probe. Seventh Heaven for Tipperary is their headline on the All-Stars piece. And Mayo refute Foundation's All-Ireland final tickets claim. So this is the Mayo County Board. There was a meeting last night, and County Secretary Dermot Bulger told that the County Board delegates at McHale Park that only two All-Ireland tickets were promised. The Foundation is claiming that 10 tickets were promised and only two were provided, but the County Board is saying only two were promised.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, so they raised 250 grand for Mayo and now they're not giving Mayo the money.
Yes.
I mean, what? You can't do that. Like, they got the support of everybody from Mayo on the basis that this money was going to go to Mayo and now they're not giving them the money.
There is another meeting taking place on this early next week. It's not going to be open to the media. There is a sense you get from the sounds coming out of Mayo County Board that perhaps they know that the money might eventually come and that they need to play their cards very carefully in terms of being political here, that they don't want to poke the bear and push the money further away.
Well, I mean, what are they going to do with the money? Keep the money? Like, it's not their money. It was raised under false pretenses that they're going to keep it. So it was raised for Mayo GAA. Give the money to Mayo GAA. I'm interested to see what Mayo people think about this. Like, I haven't heard that much from Mayo GAA. Good Mayo GAA people. Are they concerned about the fact that the county has become a laughingstock? Because it is one of the funniest stories that has happened, where a rich Englishman raising money for a GAA county is withholding the money because he doesn't think the money's going to be spent properly. Like, come on. It's one of the most ridiculous stories you're ever going to hear. And it is making a laughingstock of good GAA people and sports people in Mayo. And I'm like, what's going on, lads? Come on. So I'd be interested to hear what Mayo people think.
Yeah, apparently this is the straw that broke the camel's back. This is the line from the Foundation.
Yeah, they claimed they were promised 10 tickets for that gala dinner and they gave them away on the night and then they didn't get them. They only got two tickets. The Mayo County Board say, that's bollocks. We only ever promised you two. Like, so someone's lying somewhere. And I wonder, is there any... is there a paper trail for that?
I was about to say, where's the emails?
But you've got to have some sympathy with any county board who are like told that we're going to raise this money for you, and then the money gets raised, and you support the raising of the money. I mean, as far as I know, the team showed up to that gala dinner, right? There are pictures of it.
That's like, correct. Yeah, like they definitely showed up at a dinner in New York. I presume it is.
Well, I mean, was another one that raised loads of money. Like, let's make sure is the money definitely there? Is there evidence that 250 grand has been raised and is in escrow somewhere? Like, I think that there needs to be fairly significant questions asked of this self-appointed organisation. Because the Mayo County Board last night said Courage of Mayo is the only official fundraising organisation for the Mayo County Board. So this money is in limbo. This relationship seems to be in limbo. And I've no doubt that there are questions that Mayo County Board need to answer about governance and about their procedures. But they should answer those. And they should also be saying, you raise money on the back of your association with Mayo, give us the money. Give us the money. It's not your money. Mm. Like, it isn't. And people buying tables at that dinner weren't buying tables for anything other than Mayo GAA.
To support Mayo GAA.
So, Mayo GAA needs to get the money.
there are actual plans here that are kind of, I presume, on ice until they actually get this money. Like, the, I think there's a centre of excellence being built. The actual facilities now are just presumed put to one side until they get this cash in hand. So it's a bit of a nightmare for everybody involved. I think it actually has kind of gone beyond the point of it being funny. Like yesterday's one about the shoot a donkey being played in McGill Park. That is just, by definition, a hilarious yarn.
Yeah, yeah.
But this now, you do kind of, I am starting to feel a little bit for people involved here.
Pat Nolan has just tweeted, Brian and Ken Hogan become the first father-son combination to win hurling All-Stars in the same position. It's happened three times in football before. Can you name any of them?
Barney and Dean Rock.
That's one. Midfielders.
Earlies.
Yes, Dermot and Dermot Jr.
And what position is the last one?
I hadn't heard of these guys. Pat and Paddy Reynolds. Meath's Paddy Reynolds? Tommy's going, I think so. Yes, Meath's Paddy Reynolds. Cornerback? Wingbacks. Wingbacks. So, what year did Paddy Reynolds win? Paddy's in the 90s. Yeah. Paddy's in the team, the 97 team around then, is he? That
96.
The 96 team that wins at Ireland. The 97 team is one more famous in Kildare for beating us after a three-game saga.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that. Sorry for your troubles.
Yeah, well, sure, look, you never get over it. Right, the front cover of Ass this morning. We should just do that every morning for that sake. El Madrid despega. Madrid takes off. 5-0 thrashing of Leganés as Rodrigo opened the scoring and Jovic finally gets his first goal. And then finally for now, the Irish news this morning, 6 minutes past eight. Glenty's clinched title. O'Malley Point finally decides three-game saga. So, a big night in the Glen.
Contested free, or contested point, I should say.
Yeah, it looked... I can see why it was contested. It was on Twitter, did you see it?
Yeah.
I thought it was a point, but then there's a bit of doubt in your mind.
There is. It's very hard to tell from the footage on Twitter because it's a video of a screen. Like, only the goalkeeper and the two umpires and maybe the fullback or whoever's close to the goal have the real view of this. That television picture is not... They should have used the yellow ball maybe or something.
The goalkeeper didn't seem too upset about it, but somebody from running in from the 21 seemed fairly annoyed about it.
Yeah, if I saw that and I was like, that's the winning point, I wouldn't have batted an eyelid. But then again, there's people closer to it. You'd like to think that the umpire has actually made the correct call.
Ah, look, umpires. Difficult job, as we all know. Took Niamh Connell five finals in a row to finally win the Donegal senior football title. In just 4 days, they faced Castlerahan in Ulster. 2017 final lost to Kilcar. 2018 final lost to Gweedore. 2019 final Gweedore draw. 2019 final replay Gweedore draw. 2019 final replay 2-1 by a point. What would have happened to extra time last night? Do we know? We still don't know?
They'd have just had to go to penalties. They would have had to call a county board meeting there and then to ratify a law to allow penalties.
Because they played again tonight? Tonight. 8 minutes past eight, the very latest on offtheball.com. All Ireland winners Tipperary dominate 2019 PWC Hurling All Stars. And the story about the Kelleher penalty last night helping Liverpool pass Arsenal after an Anfield epic. Also, good conversation with Andy Lee about Ryan Burnett's early retirement, putting it into perspective from this week's episode of Off the Brawl. It is 8 minutes past eight this morning. You're watching OTB AM. If you missed anything this morning, don't worry, you can always listen back. On podcasts, the best place to get us is the Go Loud app, or of course you can always get us on offtheball.com/podcasts. The podcast is timestamped as well, so you can click through to wherever you want in our two-hour show each morning. We're back with Kenny legend Owen Larkin after this.
The Saturday panel on Off the Ball.
There's a growing hostility towards cyclists. We're somehow seen as a nuisance, when in fact we're just people trying to get to work.
I've never ever gotten one bad word said to me about my sexuality or from the opposition or from, actually in one bad time, seriously, the girl was marking me so tightly. I was like, I have a girlfriend.
I'm not the person I was 10 years ago. That doesn't worry me. I know I can play good enough golf.
Don't miss the panel every Saturday afternoon, only on Off the Ball.
OTB AM on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.
All right, I'm delighted to say that we are joined in studio this morning by James Stephens centre-back Owen Larkin. How are things?
I'm good. James Stephens centre-back sounds a bit awkward, but it's usually centre-forward, but I'm very good now this morning.
How are you finding that position and how have you found it over the last couple of years, I think it is? Of course, obviously, you're in studio here on the back of a tough enough defeat to Ballyhale.
Yeah, look, I suppose it's different. It's certainly different to up in the forwards, but over the last number of months, I think I've got the hang of it, and Yeah, like you say, Sunday was a tough day at the office, but I suppose I've learned to put those defeats in perspective at the moment, and it's a tough day at the office, and we'll just have to regroup and go again.
So it does get easier as time goes by to take them. I presume losing to Ballyhale is never an easy thing.
Yeah, no, look, you still be devastated, you still be very disappointed in that, but look, there's bigger things in life, and you just have to move on very quickly. And luckily in sport, we get the chance to sample it again and go again and see where that takes us.
You do have a brand new book out. It's called Camouflage. It's absolutely brilliant, I must say, Owen. Camouflage is an interesting title. Why did you go for that?
I actually wanted to do black and amber camouflage, and the publishers came back to me with just camouflage. And when they did, to be honest about it, I said, yeah, that's it. You know, that should be the name of it. And, you know, I was delighted with that. It shows, I suppose, the army background and, you know, obviously the background in the Depression and all that kind of stuff that nobody's seen. You know, everybody seen Owen Larkin the hurler, and nobody had to see or endure the other stuff. So I thought it was very fitting, the name. So I was delighted when they came back with that.
I want to start on the subject of sports psychology, Owen, because it's a very interesting one. Like, just first off the bat here, when you hear the phrase sports psychology, would you say it was a huge part of your intercounty career or just a small part?
I would say it was a small part, but it was a small part in the sense that we never had sports psychologists as such down with us. To the other side of that is, I think Brian Cody is probably a sports psychologist in his own right. You know, always seemed to say the right thing, always knew how to motivate players and all that kind of stuff. So, very kind of contrasting, whether you like to put it in as, you know, was it a huge part or a small part? But definitely it was a huge part. But as regards, like I say, the sports psychologists were never really around.
Yeah, and that's the point I want to get on to eventually, that Cody is probably the greatest psychologist of them all, because yeah, it doesn't actually come across as blatant psychology. But there's a great juxtaposition in the book where you talk about meeting Padraig Harrington and you talk about meeting Gerry McEntee, two very different experiences, Owen.
Yeah, hugely different experiences, I suppose. Padraig Harrington was not long after winning the British Open, I think, and, you know, I was on a potential NCO's course down in Cork and had to come up to Kilkenny to go to, we were going on this mystery tour, and we arrived at Padraig Harrington's home course, and Padraig Harrington, sure enough, came in and kind of gave us a little bit of a speech, but it didn't kind of register with most of us that he started talking about the left side of the brain, and this is the part where, you know, you function, and this is the part that does this, and we all kind of walked out and we didn't know what was going on, you know. And then you have the other side of it then, that you meet Gerry McEntee and he's just so driven, like, he talks about getting off the bus after or before one of the All-Ireland semi-finals and hitting a lad a box, you know. And he's going to that extreme, like, and you're looking at the two different contrasting figures, and like, obviously, you know, you'd have to have great respect for Gerry McEntee when, you know, he does something like that, I suppose, before an All-Ireland semi-final.
I dare say his method of psychology went down a little bit better, or it was more relatable to the team of Kilkenny hurlers at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And the funny thing is, he only lasted about 10 minutes on the field that day. He was so wound up after getting off the bus, he clocked the lad in the match as well, and got sent off. So he obviously told us, don't do that one anyway, you know. But no, look, there was very few people that came in to talk to us at the time. Gerry was obviously one of them. And after the first time we met him, you know, we were wondering, you know, what was different that he was going to say and kind of motivate us again. And every time you walked out, it was like a speech from Brian Cody. You always walked out and you said, he's after doing it again, like, yeah, you know. And that was the way you walked out with Gerry McEntee as well. It was the same. It was the same kind of a speech, it was the same motivational talk and all, but just had a different spin to it. And, you know, felt like you could really play the All-Ireland final that day when you walked out from hearing him speak.
You talk about the epic games you had with Tipperary down through the years, and you said that they had triggers like pointing to their head after getting scores and things like that. From your depiction of them, it strikes me that they're somebody who would read more into what Padraig Harrington would have to say. They perhaps read into the different sides of their brain and perhaps went to an overly scientific level with this sort of stuff.
Yeah, but I think that was more so that they weren't going to fall apart, that they were so mentally tough that they were going to keep going. And I think that kind of stemmed from 2009, obviously, the thought they had the All-Ireland won and we came back and pipped them. And I think in 2010 that was, then they started, you know, this stuff of pointing to their head. And, you know, maybe they did tap into the Padraig Harrington kind of stuff and maybe they did all that, but I just felt that was, you know, we're not going to lose focus today. We thought we had you bet a year ago. We're not going to lose focus today. We're going to keep concentrating till the very end, till the game is over.
What are you thinking when you see that?
Well, when I had to look at it all over the winter after 2010, it's just driving me up the wall. And actually, to be honest about it, it kind of motivated us a bit for 2011 then as well, because we didn't want to see that for another year. But look, they thoroughly deserved their victory in 2010. You know, I know we had a couple of injuries in that, but they were outstanding in the final, and you know, you just had to take your hat off to them.
It's interesting that you used the word motivation there, because when you're reading the book, you're trying to get a sense of what is the thing that motivates you the most. There's a harsh line from your wife, Anne, in there saying that you've got a selfish streak to you, and then that you have a line in there as well saying you went out to win Hurler of the Year, and then you did go out and win Hurler of the Year.
Yeah.
Like, I think people sometimes are a little bit ashamed of actually saying, no, I wanted the success for myself, and that helped the team as a whole. I personally don't see anything wrong with that. You know, the classic post-match interview is always, well, at least the team won, and so on and so forth. Like, that is something that clearly you tapped into, that if you got the best out of yourself, that was the best thing for the team as well.
Yeah, it was. And look, don't get me wrong, the team winning is everything, but you still want to reach your potential and I suppose do the thing that you set out to do, kind of. And that was just one of them. You know, ever since I was young lad, all I wanted to do was hurl. All I wanted to do was play for the club, play for Kilkenny, and be the best. And, you know, I knew I was in the shape. I could be the best when I came back from Kosovo at that stage. And Martin Fogarty just asked me the question. And to be honest about it, when I was in Kosovo and I was doing all the training, you know, I kept telling myself this, I'm going to do this. And that was one of the things I told myself, I'm going to win Hurler of the Year. And then when Martin Fogarty asked me, you know, what's your aim for the year? You know, the stereotypical answer was, you know, I want to get on the team and I want to get on the panel first. And he said, no, what's your ambition for the year? And my ambition, well, I said, I'd love to get Hurler of the Year. And do you think you can do it? I said, yeah, I can. And then, obviously, I went off and got. And he, in fairness to him, he called up with me the night of the All-Stars. He said, fair play to you. He said, you said you were going to do it. He said, you went out and got.
Yeah, and that kind of brings us full circle on the whole psychology point of view.
Yeah.
That is exactly how you managed to tap into your mind. That's how he managed to tap into your mind as well.
Yeah, that was a recurring thing, I suppose. We used to have one-on-one meetings with Brian and Martin and Mick, and that would be a recurring thing, you know. What do you want out of this year? And,
right.
And that was the whole, you know, that was the sports psychology that we're talking about. You know, it didn't pay someone to come down that had degrees in sports psychology and all that kind of stuff, but like the three lads were masters at.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So do you think you developed that level inside in your brain as a result of working with Brian Cody, or do you feel that you had to have some of that already in you to actually be a success under Brian Cody, this ability to have a singular focus and use that to help achieve greater things?
Yeah, I think you have to have it slightly, and I think Brian Cody then molds the rest of it and drives the rest of it out through you. I would have often seen, you know, down the club scene, you'd often say, you know, this lad or that lad has to be brought in, and often it's someone very different. You know,
right.
This lad could be shooting the lights out, but this lad is working hard for the team, and it's often the worker that's brought in, kind of, and Brian just molds them and keeps, you know, tapping into them, and, you know, kind of develops them over time. And it's like in Kilkenny, you know, a lot of lads would have opinions of who should be in with Kilkenny and who shouldn't, and but their opinions are totally different to Brian's opinions, and it's often, you know, the lads say with little or no success as an underage, or maybe had success and, you know, has been out there for a couple of years, and Brian brings him in, he just sees something in him that he can tap into and mould him into a Kilkenny player.
And that grafting nature is so important. Sometimes it can be seen as old school. Like, there's a great description in your book of you going into training and you had cold showers. We didn't want to say it to Brian, because perhaps that will come across as not having the grafting ability that you need. And there's a nice line then at the end of it saying, meanwhile, if that happened in Cork, I wonder what sort of fuss they'd be kicking up. When all that stuff is going on with the strikes in Cork, when you see some of the things that they're talking about, trying to become uber professional, what are you thinking at that time?
Well, I'm thinking, what is the point of it? You know, you either want to hurl for Cork or you don't. And, you know, as you say, we had cold showers in Kieran's, and this was probably, this could have been November or December, so it was actually, it was freezing out as well, but nobody had the guts to go up and tell Brian, listen, Brian, the showers are cold and we're going on strike because of it. You know, you'd be quickly told, there's the door and see you later. So, but look, I genuinely think all these strikes and all that kind of, they set Cork back a good few years, and, you know, all we wanted to do was hurl for Kilkenny, you know, represent Kilkenny and represent our clubs and all that kind of stuff. And it just seemed to be so different down there. Now, you know, people will argue that, you know, they hadn't everything what we had. But we had very little. You know, we had meals after training, but that was it, kind of. But in saying that, anything that we wanted, the Kilkenny County Board got for us. Now, as I said, it wasn't that huge that that we wanted. And Brian would usually tell them what we needed or what we wanted. It would never come from the players.
How do you think things would have turned out if Donal Cusack happened to be born in Kilkenny and he wanted to lead a strike against Brian Cody?
Yeah, he wouldn't have had a very long inter-county career, I'd imagine, because, you know, as we've seen over the years, Brian has dropped lads, you know, and cut lads from the panel and things like that. And I just, he'd always say that, you know, the team in Kilkenny are bigger than one person. And he'd often say that, look, your job in here, he said, careers will come and go, but your job in here is to leave the jersey in a better place than you found it.
Mm.
And to be fair, he is stuck by that right through. And he believes in that system. And to be fair, who are we to argue with it? Because it seems to be working.
Some of the Cork lads might actually agree with you that the strikes kind of did set them back years. They'll actually probably argue that if the strikes didn't happen, or maybe if their view of things was perfect down through those years, they might have gone toe-to-toe with Kilkenny a few more times. Do you go along with that at all, that they were on a par with you for a couple of those years?
Yeah, maybe they were in or around on a par with us, but I maybe the way they would have went toe-to-toe is, you know, do I think they would have beaten us anymore? I don't think so, because I think just the team that we had at the time was unbelievable. And I genuinely don't think, I think we were so mentally driven as well, not just to do it for ourselves, but to do it for everyone else, because we were so united. We were friends, you know, and it's kind of weird that so many of us were friends on the same team that we actually wanted to do it for each other. So possibly would have been closer games, but I don't think they would have taken any of the All-Irelands.
And then just the last one on Cork, how many of those players would have got into the Kilkenny team? Say, let's say the 2008 Kilkenny team, your best All-Ireland ever, and let's say Cork, what is it, 04, 05, into that Kilkenny team?
It's hard to know, because who would you drop?
Yeah.
You know, looking back on it, I wouldn't have dropped anyone.
Yeah.
So it's hard to know. Would any of them, maybe one or two of them, might have got in, I don't know. It's hard to make the comparison, I suppose, but like I just know from the lads that I played with how much effort they put in to get themselves better, how much dedication they had, you know, mental drive, all that kind of stuff. I'd find it very hard to leave any of them out and bring someone from Cork in.
Absolutely. We've spoken about the cold showers there. One of the things that you had to play through is not just cold water, it's actually true. A hell of a lot of physical pain. It struck me at times during the book. There's a lot of injections, there's a lot of painkillers. How big a part was that through? Because you had a hip operation at the age of 25, I think. Yeah. Like, was it at that, after that operation, then things changed for you, that managing pain became a huge part of becoming an intercounty footballer?
Yeah, well, it was actually before that. You know, I thought that getting this hip operation would get rid of the pain, but like I had been struggling for a while before that, and it just became part of my normal routine. Then after that, I had to get regular physio, I had to get regular kind of dry needles, you know, all that kind of stuff, and that just became, you know, I had to do this to be right to play. And you know, it was constant pain, it was constant days after matches, couldn't walk, couldn't run, couldn't do anything, you know. And But that was just the level I wanted to go. I had to go to if I wanted to be right to play on the biggest stage. And, you know, for 12 years, I done it. And eventually then this year, I find a cure. It's ironic.
So what happened this year?
Yeah, so I spoke about in the book, I went up to Sean Biles in 2015 after I broke my thumb before the All-Ireland. And I was up with a girl called Niamh Guy. She works with Sean up there. And, like, she got me back, my thumb nearly back right to play in the All-Ireland. And I was in contact with her earlier on this year, and she said, just pop up, like, you know, and I went up, and after 10 or 15 years of being tortured with pain and trying to just manage things, after an hour with her, I'm cured.
And what did she do?
She just manipulated my whole joints and all that kind of stuff, put my pelvis back into line, and that was that. And I said to her, how, after 10 years of going to physios, can you do that in an hour? And she said, it's just not practice. She said, all physios are doing now is just treating where the pain area is.
And this is a more holistic approach?
Yeah, yeah. That's so bad. I've been going to her for once a week for the last couple of months, and I have no pain.
That's incredible. You could have done with, because I know Kieran Donaghy said that he used to pop into Sean Boylan before, on the day of All-Ireland Finals, or one in particular, so he would have been around then to sort you out 10 years ago, but I suppose it's a bit too late now. Like, on that issue, it's very interesting thinking about how Cody thinks about that, because he's obviously very careful, as we'll get to in a moment, in terms of the welfare of his players, and he does care a lot. But as well as that, there is a culture of hardness in the team that was actually required for Kilkenny to reach the levels that they did. And I guess you're probably thinking to yourself, God, if I've got a niggle here, I better not complain about it too much, because I want to start on a Brian Cody team.
Yeah, and that was the thing. And often, you know, I suppose after maybe after a loss or something like that, Brian would arrive in and we'd have a meeting. And he'd call us in off the field and we'd have a meeting maybe before training. And he'd often say, you know, if you have a little pain or an ache, just get over it and get out on the field and train and all this kind of stuff. And that's going through your head then, because I was getting regular physio at the time. And you'd be thinking, I'm not going near that physio table now for a while. So, but then, you know, he'd go to the lads that required, say, the likes of Mick Fenley and myself, that required regular physio to be able to get where we got to. And he'd say, look, you know, that wasn't aimed at you two or you or the other lad. You know, go in and get your stuff done, like. But he just didn't want people getting soft in the sense of, you know, I'll just jump up here and get a rub out and all this kind of stuff. You know, he wanted to get them out into the field and get their mental toughness like that. So, which it was nice, because I wouldn't have went near the physio bed having had that meeting. I would have went straight out.
But was there lads that Cody tended to give a bit more of a break to? Like, was there a teacher's pet when it came to Brian Cody?
I don't think there was actually a teacher's pet. He did love Tommy Welsh. He loved everything that was about him. You know, he loved the way he went about the game. He loved his attitude towards it. He loved, you know, that it meant so much to him. And, you know, like, I obviously got on well with him because I'm from the same club. Jackie got on well with him. The lads will tell you I was his pet. That's not true. But,
no, yeah. Have that impression.
I don't know. It's just a bit of crack we had, I suppose. But like, if I was his pet, Tommy Welsh was definitely his pet. So, no, look, he had a bit of crack with a few lads, and you know, a few lads kind of stayed clear and just done what they had to do and that kind of stuff. But I don't think there was any teacher's pet or kind of anything like that.
You've obviously gone through some very tough time zone, as you reveal in this book. But Brian Cody plays a huge part in this. Brian Cody is a man who helps you out hugely here. Were you surprised by that, first of all, that he had this emotional intelligence or this side to him? Because he is the coach who says, play through that niggle that you have. But he's also the coach who can come to you and realise that mental health is a huge issue in young Irish males, and is something that needs to be taken very, very seriously.
Yeah, no, I wasn't one bit surprised with it, to be honest about it, because as soon as I looked at the phone and I seen his name on it, I knew what was coming. I've seen it so many times down through the years that, you know, he'll help you with this, that and the other. You know, if you go to him and you have a problem, or, you know, he's very approachable and you know, he'll talk to you and give you a bit of advice or whatever. Obviously, I was going through a bad patch, and he would have seen that the Friday night before that. He would have seen that wasn't the old Narkin that he knew.
What did he see?
Well, I went to a club game. It was the week after the Leinster final against Galway in 2016. I hadn't gone well. I'd been taken off at half-time and, you know, just went out that night, went out the Monday, and then just for the rest of the week I was just down, like, you know. I was just out of it, in bed, you know, pulling the covers up over my head, not talking to anyone, that kind of stuff. Didn't go training that week. Had a match that Friday night, and I just got up and went to the match. I was there in body, but not in mind. I just went in, got changed, sat there, you know, just didn't want to be there. And he would have seen that in my body language on the Friday night, and went home after the match, into bed again, you know, got up on Saturday morning and the phone rang. And I looked at the phone for about 20 or 30 seconds, and it was Brian Cody's name on it, wondering would I answer it or not. So he eventually answered it, and simple question, he asked me, how are you feeling this morning? And I just burst out into tears. And, you know, it's not a conversation when he's asking you questions and you're crying your eyes out on the phone. But that just simple question then changed everything. He just turned around to me and said, look, there's obviously something wrong with you. If you want to tell me about it, you can go ahead, or I can meet you or whatever. If you want, just go into Tig, he said, and if you want, just keep it between yourself and Tig. I don't have to know anything, but if you want me to know, I'm here as well. So that was the start of it then. I went into Tig and, you know, here I am today.
How long had you been feeling like that up until that point?
Well, sure, like, up to that point, probably years. Probably, right. You know, you could be talking maybe 6 or 7 or 8 years. Probably never as bad as I was that day. But I had really bad days too where, you know, I thought about suicide and, you know, suicide was constantly on my mind. And, you know, I couldn't make the connection here that I was, you know, okay, but still thinking about suicide. Anna had been on to me a good bit as well, my wife, that I was depressed and I was just in denial. I just couldn't admit that I was depressed. You know, depression happens to other people, it doesn't happen to me. But then I had to realise that if you're crying on the phone to Brian Cody, there has to be something causing it. You know, you just don't burst out crying to anybody or to Brian Cody on the phone. So I went into Tig, Anne rang Tig, and I couldn't even talk to Tig when I went in. She'd done all the talking in there. And he just asked me another question. But he asked me a question, had I hadn't planned? And I just said no. And he said, you know, if you're going to plan that, will you ring me? You know, and I said, yeah, I will. But he was talking to me as if I was after telling him I had a sore throat.
Yeah.
You know, it was so normal. It was like he was after hearing it for 100 times that day, and then he just prescribed me medication like he would for a sore throat, like he was going to prescribe antibiotics.
When he says, have you anything planned, he meant your suicidal thoughts. Had you anything planned on that front? Because I think that's a kind of an important clarification, is that when you have suicidal thoughts, it's not necessarily thinking about the practical means of how it's going to happen. It's actually more thinking what the legacy of that will be, because you talk about the financial benefits it would have had you followed through on that, which is obviously a very, very dark place to be.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, I'd often think about that. Like, I'd often get into the car, and I live about 10 minutes outside of Kilkenny City, and I'd often pull up at my door and wonder how I got there. You know, because I'm just daydreaming on the way out, thinking about suicide, thinking about money troubles, and if I was gone, you know, everything would be sorted, the mortgage would be paid and all that kind of stuff. And they're all the thoughts that go through your head, and still you don't think you're depressed, you know, or you don't think there's anything wrong with you. But, like, you know, you get those thoughts and then you come to the realisation of, look, you know, if you'd done this, you'd hurt this and this and your family. But then you start thinking about it again and you start thinking about more and more, and then, you know, it consumes your thoughts, you know. So, as you said, Ty just asked that simple question, had you anything planned, you know, had I anything planned to take my own life? That was the question. And, you know, when somebody is asking you that question, it's actually a bit weird, because you really want to answer it, but you're feeling, you know, if I say yeah or no here, what's the next question going to be? But it was so, he made it so normal that I just felt, you know, as soon as he asked me that, everything just lifted off my shoulders. And, you know, I could nearly feel, even though I wasn't better, I was on the road to recovery.
Yeah, that's the thing. It was almost like turning around on your descent. Like, because if Brian doesn't make that conversation, doesn't make that phone call, and you have that conversation, like, does the answer to his question then become, yes, I did have something planned? Do you then reach that stage, I wonder? I'm not sure if you thought about that.
Yeah, I have thought about it, and I spoke about it in the book. You know, I was probably, you know, who knows how long if that conversation doesn't happen? Who knows, will it ever happen? Who knows? It could have been the week after, it could have been the day after. You know, I suppose we'll never know that, thankfully. And, you know, I just move on with my life. But you see, the thing about it is, since I went to Tig, I have coping skills now that if I'm feeling bad, I'm wondering why am I feeling bad. You know, is it that I didn't take my medication? Is it this, or is it money? Or, you know,
right.
I can make that connection now that there's something wrong here. I'm not feeling great. What's going on here? And I think that's very important as well. But you only get that far when you accept that you have a problem, and, you know, and then you can talk about it.
So you mentioned the coping skills there, and it's kind of an internal monologue, it's an internal questioning, trying to rationalise what you're feeling. That is the single biggest help for you, is it?
Absolutely, yeah, because if I'm not feeling good now, I'm wondering, why am I not feeling good? But beforehand, I'd be just thinking, you know, everybody is going through this, everybody thinks about suicide, everybody has bad days, everybody doesn't want to get out of bed and has no motivation for that. But that's not the way it is, you know, life is not like that. For most people, and you know, it should be life should be good. You know, obviously you will have your bad days, and you know things will be bad at work, or you know it doesn't go right in the sporting front. But you have to put everything into perspective, and once you accept that, I think that's when you can move on.
What I found very interesting, Owen, was that you're not an alcoholic, you're not a heavy drinker, but yet you made a connection between mental health and alcohol, which is, I would imagine, for a lot of Irish people, a very important connection to make, that you don't necessarily have to be checked in to have a serious problem that can actually give you issues with your mental health. Could you explain that to us in terms of what you were noticing in terms of your drinking habits? And I don't even want to call it a drinking habit, because that would suggest you had a problem, because it was just shorts, wasn't it, that you had an issue with?
Yeah, so I go out on maybe our Sunday or Monday, or Sunday and Monday after a match, and you know, you drink your few pints and you get full of the pints then, and then you go on shorts, vodka or whatever. And I would often find if I went for a few pints, you know, into the local and had a few pints, I'd get up and, you know, it'd be grand. It wouldn't be any major thing with my thoughts or anything like that. But then if I went on a binge then and drank Sunday night and drank shorts and went out Monday and drank shorts, then I just did not want to do anything for the rest of the week.
Did you ever get to the bottom of that, why that was, or was there a psychological reason for that?
No, there's no psychological reason. I think it just didn't suit me, you know, and I was feeling down at the time. You know, I wouldn't have been down all the time, but certainly, you know, alcohol is a depressant, so shorts are just that thing that just triggered it for me. And, you know, I wouldn't want to move for the week. I wouldn't want to go training. I wouldn't want to go to work. I wouldn't want to get out of bed. All I want to do is stay in bed and pull the covers up, and I'd often be lying in the bed, and you know, people often talk about the fear after a drink, and I would actually get that, but it would be actually panic attacks that I'd be getting, and I'd be actually telling myself, you know, you're grand here, like you didn't do anything wrong, you're grand, and you know, you'd be grand for maybe 5 minutes, and then they'd come again, you know, so it's a wave of that then coming afterwards. But like, I could go out and drink pints all day and get up the following morning, and I'm tired, but and small bit hungover, but I don't have those feelings, those anxiety, panic attacks, anything like that. So it's been, I'd say nearly since Ty diagnosed me, I haven't drank shorts since.
Right, okay. Yeah. And to this day, are you still taking the medication? Is it just part of day-to-day life at this point?
Yeah, I'm still taking it. Look, I don't know how long that'll last. If it'll last for the rest of my life, I'm totally comfortable with that.
Yeah.
If that's what it takes for me to feel, you know, good and not suicidal, you know, I'm happy with that. If I can go off in the near future or down the line, I'm totally happy with that. But like, I'm not going to say that, yeah, I'm 6 months now, that's it, I'm leaving it at that, because that's just not realistic. I'm totally happy if I need to take a tablet to make myself feel better for the rest of my life and totally comfortable.
It seems like you have a really strong understanding of where you're at and how to get past it and how to deal with it if anything ever does come up again.
Yeah, I am. Like I said, I think there's just coping skills that you develop, I suppose, along the way. And I think that's very important, that once you acknowledge that you have a problem, then you can develop these skills. But if you don't acknowledge it, and if that phone call never comes, or if that cup of tea is never had, you know, to ask the question, you know, you don't develop those coping skills. And like I said, the trigger is always there, that I ask myself, you know, why are you not feeling great? And then I could remember then, well, you haven't taken your tablet for 3 days, and that's the reason. And then I get back on it again, and I'm grand, you know. So, but look, I am totally comfortable with where I'm at the moment. I'm comfortable with it all being out there. As I said, if I was going to do it, it was going to be all in, and, you know, nothing could be left out, so I think that's the most important thing, that you can get comfortable with it yourself.
Well, it's great to hear you're doing so well, Owen. I'm sure plenty of people who pick up the book this Christmas will relate with the story or can gain something from the story. I started at the start by calling you James Stevens, centre-back, Owen Larkin. I should also refer to you as under-19 manager, yeah. Owen Larkin. Before we wrap up, how are you enjoying that? Because there's a lot of hats in the ring to be the successor to Brian Cody at this point. It seems that every all-star at this point is putting together a fairly nice CV on the managerial sideline.
Yeah, well, I'd say I'm well down the list now at the moment with an under-19 manager. But look, I'm enjoying doing that. I'm more of the under-21s down there this year as well, so I'm enjoying that. I love being able to try and help other people and, you know, develop and all that kind of stuff, and if I can help them a small bit, you know, I get great satisfaction out of that. Obviously the winning is everything, but if you can't do that, you can help those lads along, and hopefully, you know, we'll win one or two games along the way, maybe not a championship, but who knows.
How do you see the Kilkenny managerial path going over the next couple of years when Brian Cody steps away? That could be for a long, long time, yes. I think you said in the book that perhaps Shefflin could go in as a selector first to learn the ropes a small bit.
Yeah, I could see that happening. Obviously, DJ has gone in at the moment, so I don't know, is he trying to get DJ ready for the job or not? But look, I could see Brian going on for, you know, as long as he's fit and healthy and motivated and hungry for it, which it doesn't seem to be dwindling any bit lately. So, look, as you said, there's a lot of lads with good CVs coming there, so it could be anyone. But I wouldn't like to be taking over the job now after Brian Cody. It'd be like maybe, I suppose, David Moyes taking over after Alex Ferguson.
I wouldn't be so harsh on yourself.
It'd be a poison chalice. But look, yeah, I can't see him giving up anytime soon.
Yeah, neither can I. Listen, the book is called Camouflage. It's out right now. It's by Owen Larkin, and it's brilliant. Thanks a million, Owen.
Cheers.
They spoke about your arm not being down beside your side. I mean, this is not Irish dancing.
OTB Sports Radio.
Basketball would have been my main game.
The brand new sports radio station from Off the Ball.
That's my point. Don't play for us if you're a proud Englishman.
Now broadcasting 24 hours a day, live on the Go Loud app, Alexa.
You have a whole new world of possibilities.
Google Home, tune in, and offtheball.com/radio.
This is OTB Sports Radio.
OTB AM.
Yeah, so that's the book there. It's Owen Larkin, My Story, Camouflage. And Jesus, that was amazing.
He's good. It's a very impressive story, isn't it? It's the way he kind of puts across his own struggle. And it's, I don't know, like you always kind of approach a sports autobiography with kind of a sense of scepticism when everyone comes out, but not this one for me. I think within a couple of pages you realise that he's got a story to tell, and he's telling it for the first time, and he's obviously had to decide about whether or not to tell it, because he's got, obviously, I think Vincent Hogan puts it well on the front page, saying he's got to tell his story in a very masculine environment, and he's come from a masculine environment, and that can often have negative connotations. But it seems not in Kilkenny, not when you've got Brian Cody as a manager, and that's a side of Cody that I don't think we've seen before.
Yeah, riveting, candid voice, hugely important in its openness, human vulnerability in a resolutely masculine world. But I think the point he was making there about the doctor asked him some matter-of-fact questions as if he was treating a sore throat.
Yeah.
And Owen Arkin's talking very matter-of-factly about this as if it was a sore throat. And that's kind of the stage that we need to get to in life. It's like, my mental health's not great. I take these tablets. I do this. I have these issues. I realised that one of the contributing factors was when I was boozing, drinking shorts. Like, all very stated matter-of-factly. So people listening can go, I have the same thing. That rings a bell for me. I understand. And maybe I can find a doctor who I can talk matter-of-factly to about this.
Very true. That actually stuck out to me as well, that, you know, the medicine works. It has been treated. It is something that he deals with on a day-to-day. He's got great support from Anne, his wife, in terms of encouraging him to take his tablets. Like, I think there's a line near the end of it. She's like, well, I don't want a cranky man around my house. Will you just take your tablets, sort of thing?
Antichrist.
Yeah, you're like an antichrist, as that's the line. so like that's the way they deal with it. And it's a fantastic way. It seems so obvious, but actually it's not. And it's not easy. But he tells his story in a brilliant way. And I'm confident, I'm positive that there's people who will pick up that book over the next couple of weeks and relate to it.
Yeah, and when you think about it, like, here is somebody who was going through intense pain for 12 years and managed to be man of the match in all in a final, multiple all-star, one of the defining hurlers of his generation, and who on the face of it is that alpha male, but all it took was one question to reduce him to tears, and ultimately that question saves his life. And he makes the point, if you don't have that cup of tea, in the interview that he's just done, if you don't have that cup of tea, if you don't ask that question, then you never know what impact you're going to have. So look, if there's one takeaway, it's ask the question if people are okay, and reach out if you need it. If you missed that and you don't know what we're talking about, it was Owen Larkin was in studio with Owen talking about his book. We'll have that up ready to go on podcast as soon as the show is over on the Go Loud app or offtheball.com/podcasts. A really important interview and a really important book, it turns out, as well. Just search for OTBAM on Spotify or iTunes, but the best place is actually the Go Loud app, because you can just click the button and you get it there, or indeed offtheball.com/podcasts. 8:45 this morning, you're watching OTBAM. Alan Quinlan is with us next, looking ahead to the Rugby World Cup final. Bobby Skinstad, obviously a member of the Springboks team that won the 2007 Rugby World Cup, he reckons the current crop of players can beat England once again.
Well, I'm gonna do what you know any red-blooded male in South Africa would do, and I'm going to tell you that this is the kind of game that this team were hoping for. You know, one where the overwhelming odds will be in England's favour, and that the only way that they can win is to throw absolutely everything at it and to put their bodies on the line, because I know that they're the kind of team that can. The reason that I think they could out in this is that because if this team, if all they ever did was make it all this way to a World Cup final, they'd still be heroes in all of our eyes. So for them to take the next step up is a leap that they can decide to take. And when they decide to take that as a team, then, you know, goodness help the people in front of them. And I think Siya Kolisi is leading a bunch of men like that. So I'm delighted. I think South Africa can take this.
Okay, so the teams have been named. England have named an unchanged side for the game on Sunday, pretty much as expected, obviously. George Ford will start at 10. I don't think there's any doubt after the quality of his performance, really. But there was some suggestion that maybe it'd be a horses for courses. The news, I guess, is that Kyle Sinclair is fine. Everybody else is fine who came off. A lot of people with knocks and bumps and bruises. Did Johnny May come off with a bit of a bump as well? Anthony Watson at one point looked like he'd a bit of a bump too. The South Africa team is named and Chesson Kolbe is in it. So he is fit to take his place, having not been fit to take his place in the semi-finals. I'm just looking at the bench as well.
Six forwards, two backs on the bench. For South Africa, that is.
They know who they are.
Yeah.
And they don't care. Alan Quinlan, good morning to you.
Good morning, lads. How are you?
That 6-2 split on the bench is a real statement that we are South Africa and you're just going to have to get used to it, lads.
Yeah, this is an indication of the way they're going to play, and they're not going to change. I listened to Rassie Erasmus a good few times this week, and he spoke about, he kind of answered the criticism or the questions that were being asked. Are his side boring? Are they predictable? And if so, why doesn't he change, and does he need to change? He said that since he's taken over the job, he's tried to build a foundation, really, and the simplest way of doing that is keeping it simple, if you like. And he's done that. There's been a lot said about Ireland's predictability, I suppose. South Africa are far more predictable, but they possess a lot of strength and power and bigger players, you know, who can play that kind of direct game where probably, you know, it didn't suit Ireland at this World Cup, certainly, or during the year. There's going to be no real surprises from them. I think they can play. And you mentioned Chesson Kolbe. He's a player who's just phenomenal. And if England kick poorly to him and he gets opportunities and they get the ball to him, he can be devastating. But you think about some of the times he played against Leinster last year in the Champions Cup, both times in Dublin in the pool stage and in the quarterfinal, he just didn't really get a look in because Leinster were really smart with keeping the ball away from him and not. You can target him with high balls and stuff like that, but just not giving him much time and space and not kicking poorly. So I think it's probably going to be a predictable type of performance from South Africa. And I said this during the week, it's do England get sucked into it? And sometimes you can't control that. I think Bobby Skinstead said it there. They're going to be very, very aggressive and highly motivated, and they're going to throw everything at England. It's just... The intrigue here is how England will cope with it, and it'll be a real measure and test of how good this team are, because you think back to the team who won probably the 0-3 final, how good they were at their composure, and even in that final against Australia when they dominated so much, And then the second half, it just turned around where Australia came back at them, and they were just so calm and composed. And that's one thing Will Greenwood, anytime I've worked with him and spoke to him, he's always kind of mentioned that they never panic. So England, you know, these players, after an incredible performance last Saturday, they've just got to be composed and controlled. And the physicality, I wouldn't be hugely concerned, because it comes up every time when anyone plays South Africa. Ireland were there 3 years ago, and that's all that we spoke about before the matches. Could Ireland cope with the physicality? Sometimes it can have a, you know, it can wear you down a little bit. But if you hold on to the ball well and control it and play good territory and make good decisions with the ball, I think it's not that big of a factor. I think so. It's composure and control from this English side is really key, I think.
Who does have the more physical pack then? If you had to pick one or the other, who's got more power? Who's bigger?
Well, I don't know what the pack weights are, but I think that the South African pack weight is not as heavy as you'd imagine.
Right.
I think it's somewhere up around 900 kilos. They have some huge men, of course, with Etzebeth and Diager. Vermeulen, they're all up over 120 kilos, and their props probably the same. But England are no slouches either. You know, they're a very, very big side and very, very powerful. So it's not going to be that much of a factor on. I think it'll be down to the precision of that physicality, if that makes sense. Who's more accurate and in the carries and getting over the gain line, and how good they are at the breakdown. The big problem for South Africa here could be Hill and Curry. They've just been immense throughout this World Cup. And if they get into the game, and a lot of people, I was reading stuff online, there was a bit of a clamour to try and get Francois Lowe into the South African back row, because he's such a good player at the breakdown. He's devastating at turning ball over as well, but you know, that means you're dropping your captain, Khaleesi.
Because, yeah, it was all led by Stuart Burns from Bath, trying to get the Bath man in the team, yeah. Right?
I don't know. I didn't see that stuff, but just chatting to some of the rugby people around the hotel here, and some of the ITV pundits, I think they were, some of them thought that, and particularly the English guys thought that maybe Francois Lowe is someone who can negate Curry's influence and Underhill, because this has to be a big worry, Jar, for Rassie Erasmus. There is no doubt about it. These guys have just been so phenomenal in for England, and they did it to Australia, and they did it to New Zealand last week, and there's no reason to suggest they won't be doing it again to South Africa. South Africa obviously will be very, very aware and conscious of that, and New Zealand probably. They probably believed that they couldn't have the same kind of influence as they did against Australia, and I wouldn't say it was an arrogance, but maybe just not as concerned. But South Africa will be very, very concerned about them, and it can change the whole game, you know, one way or the other. I just think their ball carrying ability and their devastation, the breakdown, and their pace around the field, they just affect so many big moments and can really stop and hamper the flow of a team. So they've got to really go after them, and you know, Steph Detoy is a very, very good player, and Vermeulen is, and Khaleesi needs a big game, so that's a real crucial area, that back row battle.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the influence of Razzie and all this. You obviously know him a little bit. It was interesting, before the semi-final he was out kicking drop goals when the team were obviously in doing their final warm-ups. They'd all gone and he was out on the pitch in his suit, kicking drop goals in his shoes. And I was like, this man's very, very relaxed it was before the quarterfinal, and, you know, it's a big game. And he is very relaxed, but he's also got that kind of a bullion personality that's kind of a charismatic, winning, look, everything's great around here. We're all going to be okay here, no matter what happens. Very important in the week of a big game like this.
Yeah, one of his biggest strengths at Munster was try to unite the group and make them happy and make people believe in each other and have a good kind of dynamic and atmosphere between coaches and players. And one of the first things I did when he got announced for Munster is I rang Vian Dupree, who played with Munster, but he also played with the Cheetahs. And I just wanted to know a little bit about the in-depth side of Rassie. And he said to me, like, that's one of the things he did when he was at the Cheetahs, one of the first things he did was brought all the wives, partners, players around his house and had a braai, is that what they call it? Everybody had food and drinks together. And I just thought it sounds quite simple, but it was kind of a case of everyone that we're in this together and we've got to build a bit of unity. And the Beast, the South African prop this week, said that, you know, he just has so much. He's never had a coach that he trusts so much and is as honest as to people. And that was the stuff we heard about him in Munster. You know, he was very, very open and optimistic and very, very straight with people. Now, some would suggest that maybe he wasn't straight enough when he left, that, you know, that he said he wasn't going to leave and then he did leave. But he's a very, very positive person. You couldn't meet a nicer fella. And I think that's kind of come out throughout this World Cup, that attitude, as you say, the drop goals. I did the South Africa-Canada game and he was at the same thing, drop goals. Seems to have time for everyone, stops, chats. And that does help relax a group of players. There's no doubt about it. So he's a kind of a unique way of doing it. A lot of coaches I would have had throughout the years would have the game face on and not really, you know, just keeping the head down really and just slight hellos to people as they're going past them, particularly when it's an hour or two before the game. And he's just smiling and being really positive. And so he's done a wonderful job. You've got to remember, Gerard, 3-4 years ago, particularly, you know, probably when Ireland were on tour there was so much negativity. Mm. And we heard about that. We saw it in South Africa when Coetzee was the coach and a lot of a division and unrest there about the, you know, the amount of coloured players and black players picked in the team and quotas and all that stuff. And that's why they brought him back there. So I think he's done a really good job. And he has a simple game plan for the team here. And if they win the World Cup, on Saturday against England, well, I'm not sure it'll have the same effect as 95, but it will certainly have a huge effect on the whole country and where they're at the moment.
In comparison to their 2007 versions then, Alan, where are they? It seemed that England, there was a bit of unrest in the camp in 07, so perhaps they weren't performing at the level they possibly could have. And it seems the tables have turned a little bit now that they're actually on the ascendancy, that they are obviously favourites for this Saturday morning.
Yeah, well, I think it's the English side, they're a superb side on, you know what I mean? What they did last week wasn't a fluke, I don't think. I still think back to probably 18 months ago when we beat them in Twickenham, and you couldn't see this coming. There was people calling for Eddie Jones's head. They lost the series in South Africa. They probably should have been beaten by South Africa, or lost to South Africa last November. They definitely, the performance against the All Blacks in Twickenham was one they should have won. And then I think losing to Wales and Cardiff and the draw against Scotland, just, it's been very kind of up and down in the last 2 years for England. But they've got this right and they've got their timing right. And I just think Curry and Underhill coming into the team, Tuilagi being back fit, yeah, they're really, really crucial. I just think Tuilagi's influence on any team, he's just a monster. He's just a brilliant, pivot for them. He can play, he can pass. And, you know, he's been injured for probably 3 or 4 years and he's coming in and out of the squads. He was at the World Cup with these guys, with England in 2011. So he's been around a long time, but still relatively young, if you like. But he looks in incredible shape and such a powerful, dominant player. Billy Vunipola being fit. So they've had a good fortune with the injury, I think.
I mean, if he gets sent home from the World Cup in 2015 or removed from the squad for discipline reasons, like, if that England team had had Tuilagi, they're a different team. I think Vinopola at 8 as well, like, you know, he had his own issues before the World Cup, and there was definitely the decision that they took was the decision that they wanted to win the tournament as opposed to we're going to stand for our values, and that's the decision they made. But he and the team and Tuilagi give them physical heft which allow them go up against any side, particularly a side like South Africa. That's why I'm not concerned at all about, from an England perspective, about the physicality this weekend. You just feel like they're able to match that, and that's why you have to make them favourites. They're 5-point favourites with the bookmakers, and that sounds about right to me, Alan.
Yeah, people expect, and I would expect South Africa to really make it difficult for England. similar to New Zealand against Ireland. When New Zealand got in the front foot, they were just incredibly precise. They were so accurate in their passing. And England, similar last week, they grew in confidence. And sometimes as a player, when you get into the game and it starts well, you feel you can build on it. And the physical side of it, England were just utterly dominant in that area last week. They just hounded New Zealand out of it. So they'll probably receive that from South Africa this week. But I just think, like I said at the start, I think there's probably enough experience now and a real determination. And there seems to be a feel-good factor of positivity there. And I think they'll have enough calmness and control to get the job done. But they're going to meet, like Bobby Skinstead said, one hell of an angry group of South Africans throwing everything at them. And so it'll be really interesting to see how they cope with that. The physicality side of it, England can cope with that. But it's allowing the influence of Vunipola, both of them carrying, Sinclair carrying, Itoje. Will he get in? Will they allow him in to mess up their lineup maul, which they use as a real weapon? Hill and Underhill, Curry and Underhill, will they turn the ball over? So, you know, if they can minimise the kind of influence of those key players, well, they'll make it really, really difficult for England.
It's funny how the maul has been a real weapon for these two teams when they needed it. We didn't really use the maul that much over the last year, despite the fact that it was one of the hallmarks of Irish rugby for the last decade. And when the team was going well, like, you know, the image of O'Connell driving the maul forward and directing them was something that was very emblematic of that team and how good they were. Was there a particular reason for that? Was it just that this team wasn't as well set up in terms of personnel? Our team, I mean, when you consider the two teams in the final, have both used it so well?
Yeah, I think it's kind of a double-edged sword, because if you maul and if you get pulled down and broken up, and it is more difficult nowadays, Ger, to maul, because the rule dictates that if you bind onto someone in the maul and it twists around, you can stay in that position, which is really looks like you're offside, but you're not. And it's very, very crazy, that kind of a rule. I think you should have to get back around to your own side every time. And I've spoken about that. So it's much more difficult to get a maul going and rumbling. South Africa, probably because they're a bigger side, they seem to get their blockers right when they win it, and they probably have that strength to repel that initial attack or aggression from the opposition. So I think for Ireland, yeah, we've used it, but not enough. And then it's kind of fashionable to take the ball off the top now, isn't it? And attack and hit up midfield and try and look for options and stretch teams and stuff like that. So, you know, if you're Ireland, you're not going to be, you know, trying to maul New Zealand off the park or trying to maul some of the bigger teams off the park. But you see South Africa against Japan, they, you know, went 20, 30 yards. You don't see that much anymore in the modern game, because it is a case of teams want to try and take it off the top.
Yeah. Yeah. I just always wondered if it was like a boxing match where you're trying to tire your opponent out by doing something that you know isn't going to kill them, but it's definitely going to, it's like the leaning on them. They have to force you off. It's an exhaustion thing.
It is, and it has a big psychological effect to a pack of forwards. And well, you know, when I played with Munster, it was an area I just loved being. Every time we mauled, and you know, you can get a big psychological blow on your opposition. And obviously, if you score a try, then it's an incredible feeling getting up off a maul and having beaten the eight guys in front of you. And it basically in a kind of a wrestling match, if you like, in that little facet of the game. So it's an area that will never go away, but it's become a little bit reckless in the last 2 years with that law change of people kind of swim around or swing around the side of mauls and just stay there. And it can be very difficult then for a maul to develop and really stay together. And then referees say, use it, use it, use it, you know.
Yeah. And you're like, oh, shut up, I'm still going forward here. Yeah, yeah. That's our decision to make. You've been on fire with your predictions so far, Alan. What do you think?
I think England will win it, but it's probably... Look, I don't have to be a rocket scientist or anyone. Anyone could probably make this prediction, I'm going to say. I think they'll win it because Farrell and Ford, whoever kicks, they're both really good kickers. And I think Pollard, in fairness, has been good. If England's discipline is good, I think they'll win the game, and they just got to stay patient. So I think they'll probably, win it by 6 or 8 points. So I wouldn't expect the most free-flowing game. But I think England, I just cannot see them losing this game now. I can see South Africa really being in their faces and making it messy for them, but I just think they'll get the job done.
You're nearing the end of your trip to Japan. Are you going to miss it?
Yeah, I think it's been different. I think I enjoyed the first couple of weeks were brilliant because I was in so many different places doing so many games. And I think when Ireland went out, it's obviously different, and the disappointment of that. But I will miss it. It's been a fantastic country for the World Cup, and I think they've really embraced it. And I think rugby, the way Japan played, unfortunately, it was against Ireland and Scotland, but those two performances really kind of grabbed the imagination of the nation, So it's incredible. The highlight for me was Fiji against Uruguay outside of any Irish games. That was right at the start when that was up at the north of Honshu Island, the middle island here we're in. That's where the tsunami was in 2011. So that whole story there where the town was wiped out and they built a new stadium there for the World Cup. And then Uruguay beating Fiji that day was just, it was a really special couple of days. But yeah, unfortunately for Ireland, I'm heading home shortly. And unfortunately for Ireland, it's disappointment, isn't it? We've been talking about it for a long, long time.
Yeah.
But I think the best team will probably, I predicted England before the World Cup, and I'm not taking any joy in that. I'm not jumping around the place happy for them, but I think they were the team before the tournament I really fancied, and I think they'll win it on Saturday.
Yeah, no, good stuff, Alan. Been great having you on. Thanks very much.
Cheers, boys.
It's Alan Quinlan live from Tokyo this morning.
He's right, isn't he? It's going to be England.
Like, it's hard to see anything else happening.
But, like, you're just trying to think your way through the certain situations. Is it possible to completely board a face-off England for 80 full minutes?
Like, they got up early in the big games that they've won recently. So if they
England can bore
early,
you back is the problem.
Fair enough,
there's a flaky pack.
Say if South Africa had the start they had against the All Blacks in the first game of the tournament, the first big game of the tournament, and they're ahead. Do England have the two quick-fire tries? I mean, maybe they do. Maybe their wingers are good enough and they're clever enough to be able to get their way back into a game with it.
But they certainly have the playmakers to do it.
They do. So it's hard to see anything other than an England win. 9:07 this morning. Plenty more to come for you on OTB AM. Phil Egan's going to be with us around about 9:15 or so to chat through last night's football, the Carabao Cup quarter-final draw and the very latest sports news. The Hurling All-Stars as well, of course. We're back talking the making of the F2 Freestylers with Billy and Jez right after these.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio. Off the ball.
If Keane was managing Pogba, he'd never sleep. Pogba's a social media star, right? He appeals to the young people now. He does his dance, he has his hair and all that. That's all he's worried about, in my opinion. He's not worried about being a great player, Nathan.
Off the ball. Weeknights from 7 and weekends from 1.
OTB AM.
Delighted to say we've got the F2 Freestylers in studio with us this morning. F2 Ultimate Footballer is their brand new book. Lads, you're very welcome.
Thank you for having us. It's a pleasure to be here.
Just reading through this, there's a lot of debates throughout the book. Did you come up with the Ultimate Footballer in the end? Because for people who haven't read the book, there's different attributes, different parts of a footballer that you put together. But if you had to pick one Ultimate Footballer that would sum up the entire thing, what would you go for? Who would you go for?
Well, this is the debate, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we got asked this before and Bill come up with a good one, to be fair. It's controversial. That's the good thing about this book, is there's so many really brilliant debates.
Mm.
And your answer was Van Dijk, wasn't it? For like the ultimate current day.
Well, I'm just saying, our ultimate footballer, you look at Van Dijk as a footballer, what can't he do? He can do the lot. And I know that you look at Ronaldo as well.
Yeah, I was thinking Ronaldo, but then when Bill pulled out Van Dijk, I was thinking, if you put Van Dijk up front, could he do a job for you? And you know he could.
Of course he could. I think it's a great shout.
But if you put Cristiano at centre-back, Would he be as effective as a centre-back as Van Dijk is as a striker? Debatable.
The answer is no, actually,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah,
the answer is no. You change your tactics
and
you go route one and Van Dijk is amazing. Even along the ground, he's going to be okay.
Yeah.
But there are going to be weaknesses. If you're coming up against Cristiano Ronaldo as a centre-half, there's going to be a few weaknesses. So I think that's a good shout. If I was going to ask you to pick an attacker and put him in the heart of the defence or anywhere across the defence, who are you picking in that regard?
Ooh, what a great question. So any striker in the world, you've got to stick him
current.
At centre-back.
Current. Let's go current.
Oh, who's going to do the best job back there?
Because, like, is Cristiano that guy, as you mentioned? I'm not sure he is. Now, this is something I hadn't even considered before asking, so...
He's a bit silky. You need one who tracks back and loves to get stuck in. Not thinking Lukaku, maybe.
Hmm. Is his, is his reading of the game good enough?
That's what I was going to question. Do you know who I would pick? And he's current, but not really, because he's on his way out in terms of career. But Wayne Rooney would be a class defender. Reads the game perfectly, can tackle, he's got the complete package.
Well, that's just cheating, isn't it? You've picked a player who's dipped back into centre mid in the twilight years of his career. He's halfway there, Bill.
Okay, all right, let me pick someone.
Well, he would need a good defender to have his back. I mean, the person who's got his back the most, obviously, is Colleen, but we won't go down that wormhole today, will we?
I'm trying to think who I'd choose. Lukaku is an okay one.
Zlatan?
He doesn't defend, though, does he?
Zlatan does. Don't tell Zlatan he don't defend.
Well...
this is just going to be another wormhole that we enter.
Yeah,
I'll accept Wayne Rooney okay, as our answer
good,
here.
Good.
For anybody who's just joining us, we've got the F2 Ultimate Footballer. It's a brand new book. We've got the F2 Freestylers in studio with us. Everybody will have watched your videos in some description. We have some people who are fanatics, some people who follow you religiously, and some people who are like, oh yeah, they're the two guys that I see sometimes on Instagram. Tell us your story. How does this happen? How do you become two of the most famous football faces on the planet? Because I think that's what you are, it's fair to say.
Wow, thank you.
First of all, it's a pleasure to be here. I thought you were going to say, and there's some people that just think, who are these two annoying guys that keep popping up on my feed?
Yeah.
But you went
Am I one of the two? Or?
No, you went nice with it. So what was the question again?
How does this happen for you? How does it arrive where you've got multiple books, where you've got millions of followers, 6.5 million followers on Instagram at the moment? Mm-hmm. Like, I was looking at the YouTube statistics recently. You're making more cash off YouTube than Liverpool FC are making off YouTube, which is an incredible statistic, really. So, like, for two guys, is that the reason why it has been successful, where people are getting straight to content rather than actually having to go through the portal of Liverpool FC or Manchester United or whatever it may be?
I think it's been an incredible journey for us. This our journey started years ago before YouTube as freestylers, as performers, and we've evolved and adapted. And then when YouTube came about, we thought it's great to put our content on there because it can get seen by anyone at any moment. Whereas our live shows, we're only performing in front of the people that are in front of us, or occasionally it might be televised. So we went into YouTube as a hobby and as a way of getting recognised for our performances. And we had to graft to get to where we are today. It took 2 years of uploading without any recognition. Not great views, not great engagement. And this is a good indication. If you want to become a YouTuber, it's not going to just fall into your lap and be easy, especially now. But there's billions of people trying to do the same thing. You have to work hard and you have to stick with what you think is right and go through a long period of time until people start gaining trust in your confidence and word spreads and you might have a couple of virals. I guess with regards to the Liverpool thing about us earning more money or getting more views or subscribers than them, I think YouTube's a very personal platform. You know, people go there because they want to relate to someone and get to know and connect with them. It's really hard to connect with a football club in general. You know, that's why they're using their players more and more now. And their players want YouTube channels themselves. So I guess that's the reason why. But for us, it's like a hobby turned into a job.
Yeah, for sure. Like, at what point do you realise that this is going to be something that you're actually amazing at, that people are actually watching you for this brilliant tricks that you're doing, for the freestyling that you're doing, for actually collaborating with professional footballers? Like, is there a stage, were you always at that level in your life where you're like, I'm pretty good at this? If there's another YouTube channel down the road who's trying to do what I'm doing, well, at least I'm better than them, because it's quality ultimately at the end of the day what people are coming for.
Yeah, I mean, it moves so fast, and to stay at the top you have to always be trying to evolve and improve. So we probably spend more time focusing on what we can do better. than thinking about how good we are. We obviously know we're reasonably good at our jobs, or we wouldn't be where we are. But we do, that's just the way we are. We do look at where can we improve. And that's probably why we've managed to maintain success for so many years. But there is a lot of there's a lot of strategy and a lot of formula to what we do. It's not by chance. When we film with players, for example, there's a lot of thought and planning that goes into how can we maximise this 7 minutes and 20 seconds that we're contracted to have with Cristiano Ronaldo to convert that into the maximum amount of millions of views. Mm. And there is a lot of strategy and experience that we put into that, and we've kind of become good at delivering for that, and that's probably why so many brands do use us, and we've become consistent at generating high views. But it's through learning from mistakes as well.
Of course.
We have put out videos before that we thought they're going to do really well, and they've done terribly. So we've learned a lot over the years.
Was there ever a football career for either of you two on the cards? Were you involved in academies? How far did you get?
And we both could have gone down the football route, mm. and probably, well, we definitely could have been a professional at some standard, whether it wouldn't be, might not have been Premier League, but we were playing top tier, well, I was playing top tier semi-pro football and at 17 years old, and I decided to stop it to go into the freestyle. And the way I come out of Tottenham Academy, Jez was at Arsenal Academy, mm. and the way I kind of analysed it was I thought I was much closer to being the best in the world at freestyle than I was being the best in the world at football. And I knew that at 17, if you're not already in that system and playing pro football, people do get steps up. But let's say you go up two leagues and you're playing pro. What happens after you finish your career? Because let's face it, the money you get from playing pro in what division, Div 2 at the time, wouldn't be enough to enable you to retire healthily. You still have to go and get a job.
Of course.
Whereas freestyle was totally new, and people were popping up saying, here's a few hundred quid to come and perform at a birthday party. Just like really small jobs, but for what was big money at the time.
Right.
You know, you earn £350 playing semi-pro football. You're getting that from a show. So to be the best at something, you have to put all your heart into it. And playing football and freestyling, there was too much of a divide because you'd be tired from football and you wouldn't be able to train. So that's why we went into freestyle, and it was the same for you as well, wasn't it, Jez, pretty much?
Well, for me, I got injured, you know, I was semi-pro, got injured.
Oh, don't use that one. I did actually get injured, but I don't know, I'm too embarrassed, isn't
it? No, I'm joking. That's old chestnut. Yeah. There's so many guys in there.
Could have been pro if money didn't go.
Pro, mate, I would have made it, got injured, yeah. Like that, cruciate,
it's an interesting.
Cruciate, yeah.
Oh, the cruciate, mate.
Like, what?
That ain't what happened to you, is it? Oh.
Yes, no, 100%. I was destined to actually become the best freestyler in the world. I had like millions and millions of wannabe Instagram followers. Then, you know, just got a cough one day and that was it.
Yeah.
Talk to me, like, just to get serious for a sec. The academy structure is something that is critiqued so heavily all across England, I think it's fair to say, like, without putting too much of a pin in it, Premier League academies, they've been criticised left, right and centre. They produce the best of the best. If you are Phil Foden, if you are going to be that absolute world-class talent, what about the talents that aren't going to make it that level? In your opinion, from what you've seen, how are those talents treated? How are they made to succeed at the tier below the Arsenals and the Tottenham Hotspurs?
It's tough. I'll tell you why it's tough, because you fall out of a pro club Premiership team and you get released, you drop down the leagues, and it's a different style of football.
Mm.
And you have to adapt, and you might drop down to these teams in a Championship or wherever it may be, and people think you come in with a bit of an ego because you've been at a higher club. So sometimes there's other players that are envious of the fact you've been in that setup and you've been there and done that. So they don't want to welcome you. I remember playing for the top tier of semi-pro football, and we had a player that got released from Arsenal to come and play for us, and he weren't welcome.
Right.
Because the rest of the lads were jealous that he wasn't in a system. Like, we would love to be in that position, go through the youths, get released, and then come and play for our team. But he wasn't welcome at the club because of that, which is really not a good thing at all. So there's a different aspect of looking at it. So it is difficult for the guys. It is really difficult. They've got to adapt to what the style of training they've had, the level of intensity, the technicality of the drills and what they've been taught, and then they step down, it's totally different. So it is difficult for them.
Mm. What do you think?
I think the same thing. I do agree with that. I think a lot of clubs are just run as businesses behind the scenes, and it's a hard thing for a lot of fans to sort of want to acknowledge in any way, but the reality of a lot of clubs behind the scenes is they do run them as very stringent businesses, and players are just numbers to a lot of clubs. And in England, I think English players are worth slightly more than foreign players at a lot of clubs. So maybe they're at a slight advantage in some ways, but then in other ways, will they be wanted to just the way academies run? A lot of them, it's like they're looking for that one player, right, that they can make the money.
That's what it is.
So they'll waste their resources on 200 players as long as they get one.
As long as they get one, they make their money back.
Mm. And it doesn't matter if you have a successful youth team that win the Youth FA Cup or they're winning the league, they're dominating. It doesn't matter. The clubs identify that one. At Arsenal at the time, it was, say, Jack Wilshere. Mm. The rest of the guys didn't matter. They knew they've got that one player that's going to go to a £50 million value or whatever it may be. So it's about finding that gem.
OTB AM on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.
I think he's quite happy, though. He's happy. It's been taken away from me. I think he's quite happy in his life, speaking to him, and he's quite content. And that's all you want. And it's important to know as much, like the biggest decision, I think, is knowing when to hang it up. Like, we got Anthony Crawler having his farewell fight this weekend, and it's the biggest decision you'll make, you know, to turn pro, to pick a trainer. All those are important, but once you've done that, knowing when it's over, and I think Ryan walks away from the game having achieved a lot more than people would expect him. Like, remember when he was like, we couldn't even get a license when he had those brain scans, those issues. And you guys know him. Like, he's a good kid, and he's achieved so much, and I think he's financially set. And why come back and get beat just because of an injury? You know, why keep forcing it and keep going and not be 100% and fighting and not doing yourself justice? So, and I think he's quite content with his decision.
Yeah, that's great to hear. That's Andy Lee talking about Ryan Burnett and his decision to retire from the pro game. That was on this week's Off the Brawl.
Yeah, up now, and kind of talks about how he's happy with the decision, and, you know, if you don't want to box anymore, definitely get out. Like.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is a sport where we have seen recently fighters lose their lives.
Exactly.
So it's not for the faint-hearted, and it's not something to go into where you're not in any way certain about it. It's not something to go into when you're injured. Like, yeah. Delighted for him. I didn't realise that he's financially set too. That's great to hear.
Yeah, so he's got some plans as well. Like, he's not going to just sit in his backside and do nothing. And kind of, because I'd say, you know, that money that you might have set aside could probably burn up quick enough. Like, so I think he's got something in mind. But we talked about it obviously this weekend as well, Katie Taylor, and the general feeling from us all is that she's probably going to win this weekend, but she's going up a weight, and the worry is that someday that's going to come back to haunt her, where she's just going to get caught with a shot that is just a lot heavier than she's used to. And
why is she doing it?
She wants to be a two-weight world champion. There's not many. Like, Ryan Burnett actually is one of the few Irish ones. Obviously, Carl Frampton as well. She just wants to go up and win.
There's no more fights and not enough money left at the last division. She wasn't struggling to make the weight or anything.
No, I think she might end up coming back down. But she's gone up 5 pounds. Like, she's never really had a problem with the weight because she's so dedicated to her training. Like, and you know, it's just the regime that she has, that you wouldn't worry about that. But from what I've seen of Leonard Atu, she doesn't look the biggest, but I've seen her knock people out that are quite big. So I'd be a little bit worried about her right hand. And look, I say it all the time about Katie Taylor, she'll outbox anyone, but when she gets dragged into a war, that's where my concern would be, that someday she's going to get dragged into war. And
with somebody who's a bigger puncher.
She just won't get out of it this time.
But all right.
I think she'll be all right this weekend.
Everybody who's watching on YouTube knows that Phil is with us. Those of you who are listening to us as a radio show this morning on the Go Loud app. Phil Egan, good morning to you. How are you?
Very well.
There you go.
How are you doing?
Tommy's angry that I hadn't welcomed you to the show properly. So, welcome, Phil.
Good to be here.
What else have you got for us? The Carabao Cup quarterfinal door. I don't know. We were told not to look.
Yeah, this is...
Liverpool Man United?
No.
Oh, come on.
Villa-Liverpool.
Ah, balls.
Yeah. But it's at Villa Park, which actually is... The dress rehearsal is this weekend in the Premier League, Villa and Liverpool on Saturday afternoon.
A happy hunting ground for Liverpool,
yeah,
generally.
But they might not play it. Who knows? Because, you know, these ties are due to commence on the 16th of December.
Right.
Liverpool have a World Club Cup or a Club World Cup semi-final on the 18th of December.
So they might...
So the AFL are going to have to...
Villa through.
Well, they're going to have to reschedule that one.
I don't think they just let Villa through. You know, it's like that time Man United pulled out of the FA Cup and ruined it.
Well, the fixture has to be fulfilled. See you at the Emirates Stadium, Ger.
What?
Yeah. That's what Klopp did say as well.
Arsenal just go through in Liverpool's stead.
Why not just throw Arsenal through if that's the case?
Oh.
But, look, I'm sure they'll...
It'll be Villa Park, dude.
Yeah, they'll find a day to play it. Klopp will play all the kids again and Villa will go through. And it'll keep us on course for a repeat of the 1994 Coca-Cola Cup final between Villa and Man U.
You're on different sides of the draw?
Yeah. Well, the semi-final draw will be open as well. But they still do the two legs. So the rest of the draw then, you've got Oxford.
Against Colchester?
At home to Manchester City.
Oh, God.
Remember, City going for 3 in a row for 4 and 5 years. Guardiola doesn't take the foot off the gas with this one. United at home to Colchester.
Ah, balls.
Now, remember, Colchester have beaten Spurs and Crystal Palace. United needed penalties to beat Rochdale.
Fair enough, but I don't think at this stage of the competition it's going to be the same, is it?
No, well, United are back. They're back.
100% back?
No, they're not. No. You know the way we talked about the multi-game viewing last night?
Yeah.
How would you take your eyes off Liverpool-Arsenal? But I actually happened to... look up. The penalties were just about to start. I was like, oh, what's going on here? Like, has he got another penalty here or what's the crack? Oh, it's a free kick. I was like, here's Rashford again. He's going to try one of these. Oh my God.
Are you bragging to us about seeing it go live? We all saw it as well. It doesn't make it any more impressive.
No, I saw it live as well. I was delighted with myself. In between penalties. Didn't miss it. But yeah, so the other tie as well, Everton against Leicester.
That's good.
Which, you know, you've two managers there that would love a bit of silverware. Marco Silva definitely under a lot more pressure, though.
Instead of just the seventh place trophy, like that is the seventh place trophy, just give them the Carabao Cup. Like, they should just force all teams from 1 to 6 to play their second teams.
No, midweek. No.
Everton and Leicester compete.
Midweek football under lights is amazing.
Last night's game was incredible.
Yeah, cup competitions, midweek, knockout football under lights, midweek. It's class.
Because
none of this giving it to the seventh place team in the league.
Because the managers don't care about it.
But no, because it's knockout. Because there's a result at the end of the night that we all understand. One team is winning, one team is going home.
And also because the managers don't care that much about it.
Pep Guardiola cares about it. Mourinho cared about it.
Emery hooked his best player. Like, Ozil was flying out there and he was like...
He didn't hook his best player to rest him for the weekend.
No, he didn't.
He did not.
Why did he do it so?
Well, is he going to start at the weekend?
I don't know.
Because that'll be a bit of a miracle, wouldn't it?
Because he was playing pretty well. He was playing amazingly well.
Arsenal are playing Wolves at the weekend. Oh, that's...
Oh, I've got to rest him here. There's a chance we might beat Liverpool in a game at Anfield. Yeah, I'm going to hook my best player when I'm desperately in need of a win.
I was listening to... I had some non-Sky Sports commentary for the Carabao Cup game last night and it was...
That's interesting.
The commentator was copping out on Kelleher's first name, calling him Quee.
Yeah.
Quee.
Is that what they were doing on Sky as well?
No, Alan Smith made an effort.
Yeah.
He was like...
Quee Kelleher.
Quee Veen.
Yeah.
Quee Veen.
In this post-match interview, they gave him his Quee Veen. They gave him his proper title. They got it right. But
yeah. They'd obviously done a bit of work on it, in fairness.
It's not that hard.
It wasn't bad. No, it's not that hard.
Like, Arsenal have a centre-half who has more vowels and syllables than you can imagine.
But they just cop out by calling him Socrates.
Yeah, actually some of them called him Socrates, which is wrong.
Anyway. I was hearing Socrates, I was like, oh, he's named after the... Okay, right, that makes a bit of sense. Here, we've got to go, Phil, we've got a minute left.
Okay, I'll just tell you about the All-Stars. 7 from Tipperary, 3 then for Kilkenny, 2 each for Wexford and Limerick, and 1 for Cork, Patrick Horgan. I suppose the big surprise, maybe some people would say, Brian Hogan for Tipperary. Niamh Connell are the Donegal Senior Football Champions. They beat Guido Orr by 8-7 on Ballybuffet last night. Rory McIlroy is 5-under after the first round of the World Golf Championship HSBC Champions event in China. Shane Larry level par. China's Hao Tong Li leads on 8 under. England unchanged for Saturday's Rugby World Cup final against South Africa and Japan. One change for the Springboks. Cheslin Colby back in. Sabu Nkosi makes way. And the Washington Nationals have won baseball's World Series for the first time. They beat the Houston Astros 6-2 in Game 7. And I don't know how they're going to avoid not going to the White House.
Well, Trump came to them at the weekend and got roundly booed.
Yeah.
Chance of lock him up.
So maybe...
It's worth demonizing a city.
Maybe they won't.
It's going to be awkward. They're right around the corner.
Yeah. Oh, look, you know, everybody's away at the minute. Oh, they're in preseason training. That's on down in Florida this year. Busy schedule. You've got a busy schedule too, right?
Yeah.
What with making America great again. Right, feel good stuff. Thanks very much. That is it from us on OTBAM this morning. Thanks very much for joining us here on the Sports Breakfast Show. Stay tuned to all the Off the Ball channels and OTB Sports Radio throughout the day. Golf Weekly is live after lunch. If you've missed anything from OTBAM this morning, Owen Larkin's interview, the making of the F2 Freestylers, the sports pages are Alan Quillen on the Rugby World Cup final. You can catch the podcast on offtheball.com/podcasts or indeed on the Go Loud app. Watch it back on our YouTube channel. Make sure you subscribe there, because anytime we go live, we'll let you know about that. Off the Ball is live tonight from 7 o'clock until 10. We've got our new documentary on Connacht Rugby, From Grassroots to Green Shirts, which was launched in Galway last night. There's the football show as well, and OTBM is back tomorrow morning from 7:30 with Adrian and Owen. We'll have Stephen Hunt and Andy Dunn in studio, and the crappy quiz makes its long-awaited return. Week two of it. You're back. You're
full
back,
7 days without the crappy quiz.
There you go.
Amazing how standards change.
See you tomorrow. Good luck.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio. That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.